with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! I'm back in the home studio, relaxed and a raring to go. This is the Horn. This is Thursday. And you know what? We got about 9 hours of conversation before Agnes and me and the kids start having to sing Bingo Jed Had a Light On. No, that's Big Old Jet Airliner. But, well, who can tell? Steve Miller's singing anyway. We've split for Netroots Nation in Vegas in the wee, tiny, small, itsy-bitsy hours of Tuesday morning, trying to figure out that, you know, I'm just hoping they seat us all together, because I figure if I'm in the middle and Margie's on one side and Doodle's on the other and I'm holding their hands, because they've never been on an airplane, and Ferg is in the next seat up holding Agnes's hand because she's never been on an airplane, we might be okay. I think there will be copious quantities of Dramamine passed out as well. Only not until we're on the plane for Vegas from Cincinnati, because it's hard to drag Dramamine zombies through airports, trust me. But we've got 9 hours of conversation between now and then, and I hope you will take advantage of it, and I hope you will help me along. Because, see, I'm just sort of getting loose from the 18th century. And I say that warmly and lovingly, because it has been a magnificent time these past couple of weeks, being able to sit in on and broadcast and stream and send video and archive and so forth of the PRISM American History series at Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. What a lovely little campus that is. And it's an excellent little state university for those of you who might need to send your youngins to a college. This is a good little college, but I really have been. I've been absolutely dipped by the heel in the late 18th and early 19th century, considering issues relating to the founding of this republic. And I hope you were able to listen to some of the lectures, because you will not likely anytime soon find gathered together in one place that much scholarship, that much depth of knowledge and understanding on a topic that the right wing has appropriated for itself and is freely rewriting at will. I don't expect it will be very long before Wall Builders, that sickening organization, comes out with a copy of the Declaration that shows that Glenn Beck's great-great-grandfather signed the Declaration of Independence, if not Glenn Beck himself, transporting himself back in time through the offices of his magic underwear or whatever. So when these, and there have been, by the way, some technical difficulties on the White Rose end of things, but they are going up onto the archive as quickly as Ben can get them there. And if you did not get a chance to hear them live, avail yourself of the time to listen to these things, because you know what? When the right wing rewrites our history, then we have an awfully hard time crawling back into the fight. It is simply, it is that simple. So that's where we begin. Simply with the hope that you will avail yourself of these lectures, and once you've heard them. And all of them, whether it's Dr. Bill speaking, Dr. Bill O'Brien, our former and hopefully future colleague here on the Horn, or whether it's Dr. John Kaminsky from the University of Wisconsin, or Dr. David House from Bluefield State University, Dr. John Tierney from Worcester College in Ohio, Professor Keith Lilly from Concord University. All of these people are incredibly talented in the field of understanding the world in which this nation came to be. So again, please, when it becomes possible, avail yourself of this information. So, just saying, you know, it's not like anybody's charging you for it. It was Dr. Bill's brilliant idea to put this out for general consumption. I know for one, well, a lot of you sat in rapt attention at what was being put forward, and it was amazing. It was amazing. I love academic pursuits and being back in a classroom and being able to have that discourse and dialogue and ask questions. Now, there's nothing like it as far as I'm concerned. Nothing at all. And I simply loved it. So please. And you know, the videos are up at our Ustream channel, the Horns Ustream channel. So maybe go and have a look at some of them there. Granted, some of our speakers were what we like to call pacers. And Ferg and I did our best to chase them along as they went with, you know, with our one camera. It was none of that Monday Night Football business. Take camera two. Okay, camera two. All right. And cue camera three. And go, camera three. No, it was strictly camera one. This was a one camera affair. Someday maybe it will be different, but it wasn't this time through. It was a single camera shot. But it's amazing stuff. I will mention at the front end of the program a couple of other things, too, just because time is limited. And I want to get this out there. I have not been able to be behind the microphone for the better part of 2 weeks. And for that reason, with a few exceptions, and thank you to the exceptions, some regulars and some new, with some exceptions, contributions to the Horn to keep us on the air have slowed to nearly nil. A couple rolled in yesterday. Thank you very much. A couple days before. It is sincerely appreciated. But it seems that if I'm not behind the microphone to say, hey, folks, we're not kidding. This is listener supported radio. It doesn't happen. So this is that part of the program where I say, hey, you know, I know, the adventure in septic systems, drained everyone, and thank you very much for all of your help. We are proceeding apace on that. I got the final bill for it today. Remember how I told you it would come in at $5,000? That'll show me. It came in at $7,000. So we gotta work all of that together. We gotta work that out by the time this thing is the project is finished and done, and that will not be until we return from Netroots Nation. Netroots Nation, by the way, is kindly sponsored, co-sponsored by the Alliance for Appalachia and Coal River Mountain Watch. They're covering the expenses of this trip. Just so you'll know, your contributions are not. What we're going to do, we are going to go to Netroots Nation in what can arguably be asserted is the single most unsustainable, ridiculously placed city on planet Earth outside of Dubai. We are going to a city that is literally powered by the rape of the Earth. It's not all happy hydropower coming out of the Hoover Dam or whatever. Oh, no. A great deal of Las Vegas's electricity comes from the strip mine coal horrors of Montana and Wyoming, and coal even from Utah. There are coal nightmares all over Las Vegas, and naturally they leave the lights on all day and all night. Special thanks, by the way. Special thanks to Horn intern junior grade Ferg. You know, he may have gotten promoted to apprentice because I'm sneaky this way. Got everything up and set up and running, and Ferg was with me the whole time. But this is how you teach the next generation. I'm sitting there running and playing with the knobs and the dials and the sliders and adjusting this and tweaking that all the way through it and chasing with the camera. And Ferg watched and learned. and ask questions. Dad, what does this do? Dad, what does this do? Well, son, this does this, and son, that does that. And then a little bit later, I would grab the side of my pants pocket as if it was vibrating. You know, my pants were ringing. I feel like Maxwell Smart. Oh, pardon me, my pants are ringing. And I would slip off for a half an hour or so and tell Ferg, you run this. Because that's how you bring apprentices along. Sooner or later, you have to trust the apprentice to do the job. And I did. And he did. And he did magnificently. I was very, very proud of my son. At the tender age of 14 years, he brought you, in full competence, a stream. He started them. He stopped them. He knew what to do. He knew which knobs did what. How to turn the remote mics on, everything, the chase with the camera. He knew all of these things, and I was proud of him for having made the dogged attempt to learn it. And you know what? I don't know if anybody else out there is doing this. I don't know where this is happening. But here's a little secret. If we are ever to overtake the airwaves that are owned, controlled, and constrained, and strangled by the right wing, there had better be more than me, by God, out there training some 14-year-old to do this next. And I'm serious about that. He's learning how we go about prepping a show. He's learning the technology involved. He's been in the room as John Fox, our chief engineer in Woy Woy, Australia, walked me through things. And I've let Ferg watch and learn. Because that's the generation that has to learn to do it next. And one of the problems that we face along those lines, in terms of taking media back from the hate-filled, vicious, the make-crap-up-as-they-go-along right wing, is that there aren't very many of those little radio jobs that I took when I was nearly his age. He's not much younger than I was when I got my first radio job. And there just aren't that many jobs for, you know, I had to go to a gospel radio station that would let just about anybody on the air, as long as they could play Dropkick Me Jesus through the goalposts of life and then segue that into Jesus, This Is Jimmy. No, I will not play it, unless you're mean and bad. Those jobs aren't there anymore because everything's automated, everything's run by a computer, and the programming comes down by a satellite or an ISDN line or some such, and there's nobody there. Human voices and talking and songs playing in empty rooms filled with the hum of computers. So this teaching has to happen on a personal level where people have the opportunities, and that opportunity presented itself. And I was glad to get the opportunity to do a little teaching for Ferg. I'm warning you, don't make me stop this program. I will stop this program and play Jesus, This Is Jimmy, if you guys don't behave in the chat room. Okay? So, there's all of that. And Ferg will be apprenticing further when we go to Las Vegas, to Netroots Nation. It's brought to you by Coal River Mountain Watch and the Alliance for Appalachia, working together to end mountaintop removal. And I've got a little mountaintop removal story for you this evening before we get started, because, oh, God, we're so stacked up. We are so stacked up. I happened to see a news article in the New York Times. I mean, it's great to see the publicity. The New York Times ran an article, our buddy Maura, our dear friend, sent this story along to me. It is from yesterday's New York Times. The headline, Project's Fate May Predict the Future of Mining. And it shows a photograph of a thin, older man sitting on his front porch, vibrant greenery behind him in soft focus in the background. Empty porch chairs also behind him, his beloved dog standing on his lap, little Jack Russell Terrier-looking little fella. Yeah, you just know he's smart. And the person in the photograph is Jimmy Weekly. Jimmy Weekly lives in Pigeon Roost Holler, I don't care how many times the New York Times spells it H-O-L-L-O-W. It's holler. And, you know, at the American History Seminar, I heard a couple of interesting things. Thomas Jefferson was a linguistic maverick. And he believed in evading the conventions of English, because he wanted to get away from all things related to the crown and our colonial servitude. An early precursor to E.E. Cummings, he would not begin his sentences with a capital letter. And he was a bit mavericky that way. So, too, was Noah Webster, who set about the business of pulling together a dictionary of American English because he, too, wanted to establish an American English as an English that was all our own. Consequently, the U comes out of color and aluminum gets pronounced and spelled the way it's pronounced and spelled instead of aluminium and so forth. So that there was a move toward an Americanized English. Wow, we got rid of that in a hurry, didn't we? Because here it says, federal officials are considering whether to veto mountaintop mining. No, see, memo to the New York Times, it's not mountaintop mining. That makes it sound like they're just a little mining company with their little Keebler elves are going to the top of the mountain and sinking a shaft and going down, 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 down into the earth and bringing out the happy lumps of coal. No! No! New York Times, pay attention! It is mountaintop removal mining, in which we remove far more than the tops of the mountains. We make them stop being mountains at all. And we've done it to more than 500 of them, and in the course of it, buried more than 2,000 miles of streams here in Appalachia that doesn't matter because it's not really America. Federal officials are considering whether to veto mountaintop mining above a little Appalachian valley called Pigeon Roost Hollow. Oh, darling, doesn't that sound quaint? Perhaps we could build one of our vacation homes there at Pigeon Roost Hollow. No, if you were to ask Mr. Webster or Mr. Jefferson, I think both of them would be happy to tell you it is what the people say it is. It's Pigeon Roost Holler. H-O-L-L-E-R, holler. It's not because we talk funny. It's because that in our region is what it is. It's a holler. You know, would the New York Times insist on spelling Wadi in Arabic in one of its stories? I think not. They would write it as it is pronounced. It is Pigeon Roost Holler. Federal officials are considering whether to veto mountaintop mining above a little Appalachian valley called Pigeon Roost Hollow. A step that could be a turning point for one of the country's most contentious environmental disputes. Stop! Full stop! Let's get this straight. Right now. This is not an environmental dispute. This is a human rights dispute. The right of humans to peacefully and quietly enjoy their lives without being blasted, poisoned, dusted, or run off the land that they have inhabited for generations. That's what it is. It is a human rights dispute. Yesterday, some heroic activists with Climate Ground Zero, climateground0.org, locked themselves down to a disgusting piece of industrial machinery called a highwall miner. The highwall miner is being used within mere yards of a giant sludge toxic waste impoundment at Brushy Fork. It's happening on Coal River Mountain. They locked themselves down because, not because it is an environmental issue, but in fact because, as they themselves say, it is a human rights issue. I don't know that the New York Times gets to pass on when, because, you know, we're hillbillies, so it may not be a human rights issue because, you know, we hillbillies may not be human. But even then, it's a hillbilly rights issue. It's not an environmental issue. It has an environmental component. But nobody that I know is in this struggle because we're worried about birds, beetles, and mayflies. We are in this because we are worried about ourselves, our children, and the ability to have a continuing future on this planet, in this region. But never mind, the New York Times, of course, got it completely wrong. But I love how they bring the politics into it. The whole thing has to do with Spruce Number One. Spruce Number One is a massive multi-thousand-acre toxic waste proposed site that Arch Coal of St. Louis, Missouri, wants to impose upon the people of Pigeon Roost Holler. They've managed to run just about everybody out of Pigeon Roost Holler except Jimmy Weekly. It's very similar to the story that came to us from that came to us from Australia that I talked about a couple of weeks ago, where one last man is holding out in his centuries-old community. The continents may change, but the coal company tactics, by God, do not. The New York Times writes, because it is one of the largest mountaintop mining projects ever. Oh, blow me, New York Times, mountaintop mining, your happy little Keebler elves. Because it's one of the largest mountaintop removal projects ever, I'll just edit on the fly if you don't mind, and because it has been hotly disputed for a dozen years, Spruce Number One is seen as a bellwether by conservation groups and the coal industry. And then the politics. The fate of the project could also have national reverberations affecting Democratic Party prospects in coal states. While extensive research and public hearings on the plan have been completed, federal officials said that their final decision would not be announced until late this year, perhaps conveniently after the midterm elections. There are quotes there from dear friends of mine, like Bill Price of the Sierra Club. And then there are quotes from the shameless gut buckets, like Bill Rainey of the West Virginia Coal Association. And he says, after years of study with the company doing everything any agency asked, and 3 years after a permit was issued, the EPA now wants to stop Spruce Number One. It's political. The only thing that has changed is that Negro in the White House. No, he didn't say that. He said, the only thing that has changed is the administration. Because, you see, that's the whole point. Mountaintop removal is illegal under any reasonable, rational interpretation of the Clean Water Act. But during the 8 outlaw years of the Bush regime, and outlaw for many more reasons than you and I would even have time to go into in the course of a 3-hour program, from the Iraq War to the Afghanistan War to the torture of people, the denial of civil liberties, the supersession of civil liberties, the elimination of habeas corpus, torture, you know. Well, it also included things like mountaintop removal, where George W. Bush said, and where's Laura? Yeah, well, screw her. You're probably off having Lupe get her a margarita. Yeah, blow the hell out of them mountains. We ain't using them for nothing anyway. But then this, the human face of mountaintop removal. The proposal to strip a large area above the home of 70-year-old Jimmy Weekly, Pigeon Roost Holler's last remaining inhabitant, was first made in 1997 by Arch Coal Incorporated of St. Louis. The legal ups and downs of Spruce Number 1 have come to symbolize the broader battle over method that produces inexpensive coal. Inexpensive to whom? To the New York Times that runs in part on mountaintop removal coal? Maybe. But not inexpensive to those of us whose lives are thrown away and just merely tossed aside on along with the rest of the waste that comes from mountaintop removal. By God. It ain't inexpensive. Produces inexpensive coal while drastically altering the landscape. Walker Machinery sells great big caterpillar, the nightmare equipment to mountaintop removal jobs, and James Milan is now the manager of Walker Machinery after they sold out to a German firm, Russian firm, who knows. That owns another firm that owns a firm that bought the Walker Machinery. It used to be a guy named Steve Walker. He was a sleazy gut bucket, too. And he said, Spruce Number 1 is extremely important to all of southern West Virginia because if this permit is pulled back, every mine site is going to be vulnerable to having its permits pulled. Losing them jobs would have devastating effects on struggling communities. Nah, Mr. Milan, you know what has devastating effects on struggling communities? Having those communities eliminated by mountaintop removal. I mean, I'm just saying. Bless her heart, Maria Gonneau, who you've heard on this program, and Goldman Environmental Prize winner, you know, the Environmental Nobel. She said, we can't keep blowing up mountains to keep the lights on. It's that simple. And, you know, for carrying that, or for saying that, and things like it, Maria Gonneau has to go about her daily business with a 9mm pistol strapped to her hip. Because, see, the coal thugs have long ago told her that they intend to kill her. Mr. Weekly, whose house is in sight of the project's boundary, remembers the day in 1997 when he decided to fight it. Nearby mining under previous permits had filled his wooded valley with dust and noise. You couldn't see out of the holler, he said. I said, something's got to be done or we're not going to have a community left. There was a lawsuit going on in 1998 that claimed that Spruce Number 1 violated environmental laws. They won that lawsuit. He and his wife did. His late wife. Jimmy Weekly is a widower now. And he carries on so that he can see the end of mountaintop removal, so that he can cross over into that promised land in Appalachia that his wife could only view from a high place far on this side of Jordan. Among other things, Mr. Weekly's been offered as much as nearly $2 million for 8 simple acres of land that couldn't possibly, under any calculus, be worth $2 million. Except for the fact that it stands in the way of Arch Coal's ability to absolutely obliterate every sign of human habitation in that area in the name of tiny, thin seams of crappy coal that will be burned up in an instant to create perhaps 15 minutes energy for a nation that can't even remember to turn its goddamn lights off. A rail thin man who enjoys sitting on his porch with a dog on his lap, Mr. Weekly uttered an expletive when told that coal industry representatives, including Mr. Rainey in an interview, referred to the upper tributaries filled in by mining as ditches that can be rebuilt. For those of you, since this is internet radio, who would like to know what that word is, I suspect the word is bullshit, because it is. In fact, some of the streams to be filled by Spruce Number 1 are intermittent, while others, including Pigeon Roost Creek, flow year-round. Here is the moment. I caught fish in that stream as a child, using a safety pin for a hook, Mr. Weekly said. If they get that permit, there won't be a stream here. And then there's Michael Fox. Michael Fox is 39 years old. He lives in Gilbert, West Virginia. He's also quoted in the article. And they call him a mine worker, which is, again, that word Mr. Weekly used, bullshit. Yeah, it's that. He's not a mine worker. He's a demolition operator. My grandfather was a mine worker. And he was a member of a union to prove it, of mine workers, the United Mine Workers of America. My grandfather was a miner. My father was a miner. My great-grandfather was a miner. Michael Fox, 39, of Gilbert, ain't no miner. He's a heavy equipment operator. Or a dump truck driver. He ain't no miner. But anyway, he wants Spruce Mine number one to go ahead and so that all those thousands upon thousands of acres can be relentlessly and mercilessly raped, pillaged, plundered, and tormented and destroyed. He wants that. You know why? Here's what he said. I have three kids I want to send to college. Why, Mr. Fox? Why would you want to send your three kids to college? Why don't you want them to go into daddy's work? Don't you want them to go up and work on that mountaintop removal site, Mr. Fox? Or are you planning on destroying everything in West Virginia so that there won't be any mining jobs for them to take? I want them to go to college. Yeah, look at my new haircut, Andy. It's all slickety in the back. Really, Mr. Fox, you don't want them to go up on the mountaintop like you do and blow it off and destroy it and poison the water and ruin the wells and create moonscapes that a buzzard flying across has to pack a lunch for? You don't want that for them, Mr. Fox? Then why in God's name do you think we want it for any of ours, you dirty son of a bitch? But see, that's the toxic algebra of need that is attached to mountaintop removal. And that's a starting place this evening. Oh, Lord God, we've got others. We've got a Sandra sent along a prophecy moment for us. And we'll get to that. And somewhere in America, Tony Bourdain, the only television person I watch with any regularity at all, Tony Bourdain, whom I'm trying to get on this program, Tony Bourdain somewhere is quietly laughing. No, hell no, he's guffawing out loud over a glass of really good cold beer somewhere, maybe. Because of a story that Texas Betsy sent along. You're going to love this. Oh, no, we've got it. And we got a little history lesson. Yeah, see, I've been immersed in history, so I can't resist pulling up a history lesson because, well, see, the right wing's out there, and they want to drop the hammer on immigrants to this country because they say the Bible says to, and history is behind us. See how they make it up as they go along? Yeah, but I'm just saying. So we got all of that going for us this evening. Because we got to cram a lot into a little bit of time before. And just to wrap up and tell you, the way it's going to work at Netroots Nation, we're going to get there on what would be mid-afternoon our time Tuesday, but will actually be morning. And we'll probably all be half-addled, except for Ferg, who, Dad, I want to go to the pool. So where's the show, girls? You know. But anyway, we'll take some adjusting and getting used to. The following day will be spent in recon. We will recon everything, trying to figure out what rooms we're going to be in, covering which panels. Making sure the equipment has survived the trip with the bags being flung around by non-union baggage handlers from here to Timbuktu. And I'll have to make a run down to the casino because I'm obliged to now play $2 on the roulette wheel on red number 13. That will be the extent of my gambling experience. And, you know, of all the vices I've had access to along the way, gambling's just never one that got, oh, here, let me give you my money and get nothing for it in return. Thank you. Oh, I lose? No, shit. Okay, bye. Oh, too bad, Bob. But anyway, I'm obliged. And then Wednesday we will start up with panels and coverage of the plenary sessions. Who knows? I may even talk the lovely Agnes into slipping in behind a microphone for a little bit. Who knows? Who knows? Matt Osborne will be with us. The great Appalachian activist Bo Webb will be with us. Hopefully he'll find some time to get behind the microphone as well. And we will be posting stuff. Matt will be blogging like a wild man, and he'll be posting stuff. I'm going to work on furthering my blogging skills some more, and hopefully I'll be posting some stuff. It's gonna be a fascinating time, but that will go on 22nd, 23rd, 24th. I'm not sure it goes through the 25th. I don't know if there's going to be anything to broadcast. That's a Saturday anyway, and then we're home on the 27th. And that worked out that way because of how the plane ticket prices worked out. It cost less money to stay an extra day. So that's the plan, just so you'll know what's going to be going on. And all of it will be posted for you there for your perusal at headonradionetwork.com. We will archive, and I will transmit the archiving to Ben Birch, and it'll be there for your downloading and podcasting enjoyment. It's going to be a busy time. It's going to be a very busy time. But I'm hoping we can simply raise awareness in the most unsustainable city on planet Earth outside of Dubai of what's going on in coal-ravaged communities in Appalachia. I'm hoping we can raise some awareness. Because out of the 100 panels or so there at Netroots Nation, I counted them up, I think there's four or less that have anything to do with the environment. And there's nothing that has anything to do with the human rights of people that have coal operations breathing down their necks. Not a one. So it's going to be up to us to create that awareness. Agnes and the girls at the Coal River Mountain Watch table in the exhibit hall, and Ferg and I bringing panels, bringing you various and sundry panels. So we'll take a break and see what your thoughts are. You are listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice, emphasis on listener-supported, I might add. You're listening to The Horn, and I'm Bob.
Today you blasted near my street, and my house cracked at my feet. I can't help it if my home is in your way. Politicians by your side, they look so satisfied. I can't help it if my home is in your way. Promises you made amount to stealing. As a giant rock lands on my Chevrolet, suddenly I got that lawsuit feeling. I can't help it if my home is in your way. Hard to know that the sheriff's lips will kiss you. Now, where they kiss you, I can't say. We're asking for a big injunction issue. We can't help it if our homes are in your way. No, we can't help it if our homes are in your way.
You know, it's kind of funny. That applies to the entire region of Central Appalachia. All of our homes are in the way. Every last one of them. And Jimmy Weekly's home is certainly in the way of Holy Prophet, where Arch Coal is concerned. Of course, they figure, you know, if they just up the ante a little bit, you know, Jimmy's bound to have a price. You know, hell, maybe we'll just run it up to $2.5 million, and then he'll say, come on in here and bulldoze my whole heritage and bury everywhere that means anything to me on earth. I got me some dollar bills that's made of paper money. It ain't worth shit. Yeah, maybe that'll do it for him. You can buy him a McMansion somewhere on a floodplain that nobody disclosed. That's what we can do. Yeah, you betcha. Enough of that. You know the phone number, right? 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel. It's 304-658-3333. Email comes into Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, @gmail.com. You know, I assume you know these things, but you never know when somebody's listening that never called before, never emailed before, and just might want to know how. So yeah, that's what it's there for. Let's do go to the phones, though. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hey, Susan, what's up?
Well, for those few people who I'm sure haven't heard of it yet, if you go to the show post on the main page, there's a really pretty picture. I don't know how long it's going to last because I don't know how long the whole thing's going to last, but it's a screen cap of the Deepwater Horizon well.
Not leaking.
And everything around it is blue.
That's a lovely picture. I'm looking at it now.
Yes. Now we shall all cross our fingers and toes and pray to whatever God we happen to point to.
That it stays that way.
Stays that way. But, oh, it's nice to see something besides that revolting brown crap.
Yeah, and now if we can just keep it off the beaches. Yeah, I got a question for you, Susan. Now that this gets done, though, does Barack Obama get any credit for it? The pressure that he has tried to keep up on BP and the negative, you know, the negative vibes that he's generated toward them, and does he get any? No, I don't think so.
Well,
does he?
Of course not.
Jesus capped that well.
He could cure cancer.
Jesus, BP Christ capped that well.
Find the formula for immortality and any other impossible thing. And the Republicans would still call him a socialist.
Indeed.
You know that as well as I do. That man can't do nothing right. I don't care what it is as far as the Republicans are concerned. And as far as the Dems are concerned, I really think they ought to give him a lot of credit for it. But then more needs to be done. Keep up the pressure.
Absolutely. And the thing is, I was having a discussion with Boss Man Wayne earlier today. And the thing we need to remember, because did you see the story about the Marcellus Shale gas well catching fire?
Yeah.
See, they're drilling as deeply through the ground as BP was drilling under the water.
Uh-huh.
And you got the same sort of set of problems. They've learned the technology for the extraction, but not for the remediation. We got lots of things to keep our little, you know, our little gnat-like focus on.
Yeah, Koss said something in the chat room that's perfectly germane to this. Pull all the permits now!
Yeah.
All of them.
You know, New York State has placed a moratorium on Marcellus Shale drilling. Pennsylvania's thinking about one, but down here in the free state of resource extraction, we ain't got any, none, zero, zilch,
well,
zip,
yeah.
Nada. Wild West again.
Uh huh.
Oh, and by the way, don't get me started on our governor's relentless, shameful, pathetic lust for a Senate seat. Don't take me there.
Oh, tell me about it. Who's going to be this poor sod that's going to temporarily warm that seat till he can slide his little butt into it?
No clue. Maybe Gaston Caperton. Maybe Alan Mollahan, you know, some cipher. Maybe Bob Wise.
Mm-hmm.
I would just like to hope that one of them has enough of a enough of the political reptilian sense that maybe he'd decide. And see, that's what militates against a Gaston Caperton or a Bob Wise or someone like that, because this has to be somebody who will get bought and stay bought, and not get all uppity and decide to run against Lord Joseph of Manchin, because you know that's his seat. God wants him to have that.
Well,
you know, all the little fetuses that he supports, and all the coal barons that'll give him money. You know, that's Joe's seat. Pretty sickening.
Very sickening.
So there's that.
But we have one very, very small piece of good news, so I prefer to...
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm sorry. I don't mean to be a schleprock and just downer everything. No, I was happy to see the news that the new cap had worked. But I can't help what I am, because... where this disaster is concerned, by God, BP has made me what I am, and that is very skeptical.
Yeah, you and me both. Personally, I think what they're the whole thing behind this, I personally think they could have done this 3 months ago. But I think what they needed to do was find some way so that they could still tap that well.
Yeah. They got to figure out a way to keep getting the profits out of it. So now that they've got it capped, you know, maybe the relief well can turn into the new well, and they'll still get the oil. Ooh, isn't that nice?
Yeah.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah. I could say something rude, crude, and unladylike, but I won't.
Because we all know you're a lady.
No.
No.
It's just that. I realize there's kitties might be listening, and I don't want to say something nasty.
Understood.
I personally, if I were to have my way, if this were my perfect universe, and I could wave a little wand and said, this is the way it's going to be, I would seize everything BP had in this country, and that includes oil leases.
Darn straight. Oh, and by the way, where was I going? I'm a bumblebee right now. I'm tired. There was something else I wanted to mention too. Oh, yeah. I know. You know about the Battle of Blair Mountain, right?
Yes.
Guess what? They're bulldozing it.
Well, of course they are. They don't want the reminder of the union, what can happen when you unionize, to be there as a symbol for people to rally around.
Jeff Biggers had a magnificent post over at Huffington Post today, chronicling it, including video shot by a researcher from UCLA who has come to chronicle what is being done to this most hallowed ground of the labor movement. They've bulldozed a bunch of it, and oddly enough, you know where they're bulldozing? Right smack dab in the most archaeologically sensitive parts of the region, of the area.
Well, that's so that a couple of years from now they claim, well, that never happened.
You know, they really don't have to do that, Susan. They've been doing that for 100 years. Okay, 80.
Yeah, I know. But this way, now they're dead serious about it, and you know, they're doing it with Bush. And they're really heavy into rewriting history these days.
Oh, don't I know it? I've got one of those in the stack for this evening, assuming I get to it.
You know, God, I just love these people. I really do. They're just anyway. I shall let you go, and I'm sure you got Blinkies going.
You got it started. Yes, indeed. Got a couple going.
Yeah. Shoot me any information you have on what times and stuff like that. So for Netroots.
Absolutely. I absolutely will. The only problem is this is going to be even more fluid than what this last thing was. This last event had a schedule. And this thing will be changing up to the day of, I suspect. And we will, what I'm going to wind up doing is printing out the entire panel schedule and going over it with a couple of highlighters and prioritizing. And then when we do the recon, figuring out we need to be in room this then and room there.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be hairy, to say the least.
Oh, yeah, I understand that. But if nothing else, you'll have fun.
Oh, I know. Well, no. No, if nothing else, we will have work. Let's not kid ourselves. If I can relax at the end of the day and just blow the carbon out a little bit, I'll be fine. I don't have to go out. I don't have to be Clark Griswold at the blackjack table. Oh, I'm sorry. We've got 20.
Okay. There is one thing, a message for FERC.
Yes.
Tell him if he's going to go looking for showgirls, he needs to take along a handkerchief so he can wipe the drool off his chin.
Yep, indeed, because he ain't going to have to worry about wrapping that rascal. He won't get within 100 feet of him. Yeah, for those of you who have watched Las Vegas Vacation, yeah, just think Mr. Papa Giorgio. Not.
Yeah.
I'm very happy because what he really wants, and what ain't going to happen either way, because the money's not going to be there, he wants to ride the roller coaster on top of the skyscraper and or go jumping out of an airplane with the flying Elvi. I respect his ambition, but it ain't going to happen.
Is into roller coasters?
Sadly, yes. Come on, Dad, why won't you ride one? Because I don't like them, okay?
My kind of person.
Not mine. Oh, no, he wants to go to the top of that stupid hotel and do the free fall drop, and then he wants to ride the roller coaster, and no.
Hey, I could do a whole riff on roller coasters.
I can do a whole Ralph on roller coasters, and have
well, I understand
the couple
that.
Of times I've gotten on them.
I understand that. I went both.
You know, I think the one I was on went from the Magnificent Comet to the Vomit Comet in the space of about, 2 seconds, courtesy of me.
I got my start on an old, creaky, wooden one with a nasty reputation of jumping the tracks.
Ew.
Yeah, I did. They would do that about twice a season. And needless to say, the result wasn't good for whoever happened to be riding it at the time. But
see, I'm not convinced that can't happen now. So it's just as it look. You know, if I want to go fast and be afraid I'm about to die, I own a motor vehicle and I can get on the highway with the coal trucks.
Yeah, that's true.
With the added component of very, very stark realism. Susan, have a wonderful evening.
Give my love to Agnes.
All right. See ya. Bye now.
Bye.
News Ninja Susan calling from Oregon, and onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Brother Bob.
Hey, what's up, Cossack?
Not much. How you doing?
I need a nap, but we'll be all right.
You're holding it together.
A little bit, yeah. This has been a long couple of weeks. It's been really, really exciting and really intellectually stimulating. But it has been physically exhausting, not that I'm complaining.
Oh, yeah. Well, we appreciate your effort.
Thank you, Cossack. I really do appreciate that being said.
It's true.
You got to listen to some of it, didn't you?
Oh, God, yeah.
Pretty cool, huh?
I enjoyed the heck out of it, but then again, I'm a history nut anyway. So, that goes without saying.
But, you know, for me... The real litmus test on this was, you know, Ferg is not old enough to be a history nut yet. And he was sitting there a couple of times, you know, when I was running the board and he wasn't apprenticing. He was sitting there with his elbows on the table and his chin in the palms of his hands, just tracking the speaker, hanging on every word. And he has become fascinated with James Madison.
Good one to be fascinated with.
Well, he came away with one of Dr. Kaminsky's little chapbooks and started reading on it immediately. I gotta know more, Dad. You like hearing that coming from your kid. I need to know more.
Kind of it's one of those things you don't think you're going to hear, but when you do, it's good to hear it.
It gives one hope, especially when the one involved is a parent.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's kind of why my old man was thrilled about me bombing my way through the local library. Once I was done in the kids section, he had to go down there and almost had a fist fight with the librarian because look, I want my kids to be able to get all the books in the library. But he's not an adult yet. He's read everything in the kids section. But he's young. He's my son. Let him read.
He ain't going to be young forever. And this will help him when he's not.
And it worked. We got lucky. It worked.
Well, lucky for you, it wasn't in Texas.
Oh God!
See, you look at the whole thing about what went on in the last couple of weeks is you have to view it through the prism of the present. And so I start thinking, you know, maybe that wasn't such a bad idea if, in fact, Aaron Burr, I almost said Raymond, sheesh, Della, it's not such a bad thing if Aaron Burr would have gone ahead and conquered that region and set up something that maybe wouldn't have turned into what we have today.
Yeah, but we would have overridden it anyway, just like we did with all those natives whose thousands of treaties we decide to break unilaterally whenever we...
But remember, Aaron Burr was not in favor of slavery.
Yeah, that's true.
So there would have been no Alamo and no fight to maintain slavery.
God. I don't know. I wonder sometimes about our history. And the way our history is taught is really unbelievable, just unbelievably bad, actually. And what they should have as mandatory text for history, like a people's history of the United States, is usually banned from the freaking library. That's insane.
Yeah, it is.
You know, things like that, things like, yeah, if you want to teach people how to think about history, why don't they ever show Connections? Remember that series from the 80s?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I do.
Yeah, that's the way history should be taught, because rather than a bunch of disjointed times and dates, this tells you what history is. Everything hooks into everything else.
There were so many things mentioned at this seminar, Cossack. One of the things was the note, you know, we tend to view it all as inevitable. That phrase sticks with me. And it wasn't. It could have come out any number of ways, among other things, but for the fact that Alexander Hamilton, an ass, stood up and delivered 4 hours on why he thought that the new republic should be something approaching a despotic tyranny. The centrist position of the Virginians, which was at the time viewed as the radical position, Dr. Bill explained this to me, the Virginia position got pushed to the center by the wild-eyed right-wing radicalism of Alexander Hamilton.
Correct.
Who, you know, I mean, he may not have been happy with naming the head of the country a monarch. He may, for all we know, he may have wanted to make him pharaoh, you know, God on earth. Probably not true, but
he was pushing very hard for Washington to be proclaimed the monarch. It was Washington that beat him down and said no.
Well, Hamilton. That was Hamilton putting his nose up Washington's backside.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, we were inordinately lucky that Washington really was the modern day version of Cincinnati. Had he not been, we would have been in a heap lot more trouble than we are. I mean, he really was rather remarkable. Now, the more you read about him, the more you realize, damn, he really was something else. And we were lucky to have him. And he released all of his slaves upon his death.
Well, did he? Because maybe I'm transposing something, but wasn't there something in the course of the lectures about the fact that Martha had planned or said that she would relinquish her slaves or manumit her slaves upon her death, and it got around the slave quarters, and suddenly she wasn't feeling so secure, so she went ahead and freed him. Lest someone sort of, because she was afraid she was going to get her throat slit in bed.
Well, thank God for that. Fear can sometimes motivate you to do the right thing. But, I don't know. Somehow we sort of started out down the right path, and we got waylaid real early on.
And that's the thing, and if this seminar is slated to continue next year, and next year will be the 19th century, and that's the question I really wanted to ask was, you know, where did we jump the tracks? You know, early on we had lectures about the Enlightenment, yeah, and this was the stuff that Dr. Tierney was talking about, the foundation of this country, the Declaration of Independence, even the Articles of Confederation and up into the Constitution, are founded and grounded in the Enlightenment, which is an accurate word for those times because they had become enlightened, many of them, and gotten away from notions of imaginary gods dictating the course of men.
Right.
And they were enlightened, and they realized that they didn't have to bow to any priest or get mumbled at in order to form a government. But then comes something, a period that I'm sure you're familiar with as well, in the 19th century called the Great Awakening.
Right. Well.
And I cannot imagine for the life of me, Cossack, a greater misnomer than describing a bunch of fundamentalist preachers getting their hooks into a bunch of semi-literate to illiterate credibles with their fundamentalist thinking. I can't imagine a greater misnomer than calling that an awakening. It was what would you call it? It was the return to darkness.
Exactly.
And well, I say that again. I say that being related to one of the people who perpetuated the darkness. And rather a famous one in these parts.
Who's that?
His name is Sam Black. It's the only zip code in the country that's a zip code without a town of some sort, any sort. Sam Black Church, West Virginia.
Hmm.
And Sam Black was a circuit rider, as I've noted on the program before.
Right.
He could smell chicken frying from 50 miles away, because the man never did an honest day's work in his life. All he did was ride from church to church telling white people that God said they had the right to own black people and Jesus wanted them to have slaves. I mean, he was a real, and I'm talking about my own family. He was a real piece of crap. He spent the Civil War on the run from Union troops.
Good.
Because he didn't have the courage to stand up and face them. And again, but he wasn't the only one. You know, there were lots of them standing in pulpits all over the south of the United States, pointing to letters from so-called Saint Paul, in which it was explained that the white man was meant to own the Negro. And you know, that along with the fact that my grandfather was a member of the Klan, You know, these are things that as a Southern man, I guess in what I'm doing and what I've done for the past several years, I'm kind of, in my own way, I'm trying to do my own expiation, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
You were listening to that song by Neil Young?
Southern Man?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Geeky trivia time. Most people don't realize that Neil Young and Van Zandt from Lynyrd Skynyrd were actually friends, and that the song was written as a needle job, but it was not as a hateful needle job.
Oh no. But I always liked Young. Had a very strange.
Well, I did too until he became a loyal Bushy right after 9/11. Then I had issues.
I can understand that.
Well, how
I mean, for the life of me, I don't understand how anybody could become Bushy under any circumstances.
But there were a lot of people who did.
Oh, yeah.
You know, all this, and you know, it seems like everything has a West Virginia connection. All this business that I've missed out on in the course of being away from the microphone with Mel Gibson. Who once again showed his true colors. I was reminded when I read that he settled his daddy here. I don't know if Hutton Gibson is still alive.
Mm-hmm.
But Hutton Gibson was a sickening racist and a disgusting anti-Semite. And when Mel needed to get him out of the spotlight, he settled him in a little town about 20 miles from here.
Oh, great. And
Hutton Gibson said the reason they came to West Virginia was because everybody knows that the people in West Virginia are hard workers, and a Jew ain't going to go nowhere where he has to work hard.
Oh, God.
So all this stuff is no surprise with Mel Gibson.
Where do these people come from, for God's sake?
Under rocks, out from behind baseboards. They're, you know, they're basically the cockroaches.
And you're really going to sit there and hit the mother of your child in the face while she's holding your child.
Yep. Because that's who he is.
What kind of awful does that?
And that's O-F-F-A-L, unless I misinterpret you, yes. The Mel Gibson kind. See, but you know, we can't just say, oh, Mel Gibson's a bad person. Because to do so, Cossack, why am I doing celebrity gossip? No, it has a wider meaning. It really does. And you can't just say, well, you know, Mel Gibson's an ass. Because he is, but he is an ass who is a product of his ass world. Jesus, that sounds like a follow-up to Westworld, doesn't it? You know, instead of Yul Brynner's face coming off and all the circuits and the circuit boards being, but no, Mel Gibson's face comes off and it's all worms and toads and fleas and flies and roaches and stuff. But anyway, Mel Gibson's a product of his world. He is first of all the son of his sickening bigot father, and secondly, he's one of those weirdo I hate Vatican II Roman Catholics. He wants he wants all of his masses in incomprehensible Latin. He wants women in the back of the church with veils over their heads. He's fond of that rosary in one hand, dead chicken in the other, Roman Catholicism. He thinks that John the 23rd was a heretic. And to the tune of millions of dollars, he funded a Roman Catholic church in Malibu that preaches all of that hateful garbage. And the one thing I haven't seen is anybody sort of tying it all together because you know, all the celebrity guys are, oh, look, Mel Gibson, oh, my God, really? He did that? Oh, I can't believe it. Why not? This is the world he comes from. My God, he was married to a woman who gave him 10 children, but who had committed the grave heretical crime of being an Episcopalian, and he routinely told her that she was going to hell? You know, the guy can't make a movie without a phalanx of Thai hookers on the set. But you know, he's for traditional marriage and family values.
Bull. Just like the rest of them, none of these people they talk a good game that they don't live up to it at all.
No, they're functionally unable to do so, Cossack. They're they are constitutionally unable to do so.
Of course. I mean, like, you've heard there's more coming out about our dear friend, Brother Vitter.
Oh, God, yes.
Jeez.
I just want to find somebody who knows, not where the bodies are buried, but where the diapers get dumped. Oh, I hate myself.
And how in God's name can the, quote, God-fearing masses of Louisiana vote for this man?
Well, for starters, because we're not running anybody with no Democrat in Louisiana with the stones to confront him about all this stuff is running. Because, you know, that's what Republicans do. Republicans use sex against Democrats. Democrats don't use sex against Republicans because, you know, we're pusillanimous and scared. I mean, my God, did you see this business, Cossack, where Harry Reid called out Barack Obama for being a wimp?
Yeah.
How sad that Harry Reid is right.
True. But still, this is your side of the aisle, you know. Circular firing squads are not useful.
Not hardly.
I mean, you know, Barack Obama is a wimp. He has turned his back on his constituency time and again and sold out to the Republican. And he's going to be, you know, a one-term president at the rate he's going.
And you know what? Even as frustrated as I get with him, that scares the piss out of me.
It does and it doesn't. I mean, I'm working on a piece right now anyway. It'll be up on my blog eventually once I'm done with it. But the thing is, I'm a little bit sick and tired of hearing, you know, just like when Barack Obama was elected. Oh, we've elected our first black man. Big deal. What has he done? I don't care who he is. You know, it's like if we had gotten that Herod and Clinton in there, that nitwit. Oh, we got our first woman president. So what? You know, identity politics are poisonous as all get out. And they're worthless. It doesn't matter whether it's male, female, black, white, whatever. It's the content of their person. This is what...
You mean what Dr. Kig was talking about, judging a man by the content of his character?
Exactly. It's the content of their character that matters, not whether they are black or white or male or female. I mean, I've heard so many times from all the loudmouth feminists that I know, well, if we just had a woman in there, she would make good womanly decisions. Yeah. You mean like Golda Meir? You mean like
Margaret Thatcher?
Margaret Thatcher? What's the one in India? Indira Gandhi.
Indira Gandhi, corrupt.
All these women.
By the way, Indira is Hindu for corrupt as hell.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter whether they're female or not. It matters what kind of a person it is.
You would think.
You know. It would be much different if the unions had gotten someone like Randhawa Shibu in there. You know? She's an actual human being who happens to be a woman, but she's a humanist.
You know what? Expecting someone to do something spectacular because of the color of their skin is, in a way, to my way of saying it, or my way of thinking it, itself a form of racism.
Correct.
So, you know, call me crazy, but yeah. Hey, Cossack, I got to run, brother, but it's been a great conversation.
All right. Take care.
All right. You have a good evening, my friend.
You too, sir.
All right. And by the way, thanks for listening in on the lectures. I'm really glad you did.
Oh, it's great.
And I'm glad that folks can hear you offer your own endorsement. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Take care, brother.
Take care.
Bye now.
Bye.
The Cossack calling from North Florida. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey.
Hey, it's Michael. Can you hear me all right?
I hear you just fine, Michael.
Oh, okay. So how are you doing? How was the lectures? I only got to listen maybe 2 or 3 days, but it sounded very interesting.
Oh, it was fascinating, Michael. It was absolutely wonderful. I love participating in that kind of, you know, and I keep calling it academic, but, you know, damn it, the framers didn't think that it was supposed to be that. They wanted the discussion, the rational discussion of the nature of what the republic would be, to be an ongoing national discussion. But I don't think they I don't think they foresaw Glenn Beck.
No, I don't think they'd be too happy about it either.
I can't help thinking they wouldn't.
Yeah, and I heard that you snuck away a couple times to let Ferg take control of the knobs.
Yep, and he did a magnificent job.
He seemed to enjoy it?
Yeah, he did. I think we're going to have to promote him, Michael.
That's good.
Yeah, he's no longer Horn Intern Junior Grade. He's now Horn Intern.
Awesome. Well,
and he's working on being Horn Apprentice. He may come back. He may come back from Vegas full fledged apprentice. Eventually, eventually he may be. He may be Mr. Crusher.
Yeah, I just had to call in. You kind of summoned me. I don't know. You maybe didn't mean to do that.
Did I conjure you?
Kind of summoned me.
I do
you
that.
You kind of conjured me. The Neil Young comment. I had to call in and challenge that assertion. You said he's a loyal Bushy.
Yeah, he was. Right after 9/11, he became a loyal Bushy.
What? Well, how long did that last? See, whenever the topic of...
Oh, no, he came back. He came back to his senses.
Okay. Yeah, I was gonna say. I mean,
but that really was sickening.
Well, see, I'm not okay. I'll just confess. Oh, well, I'm driving right now, so I can't really exactly look it up. But I'm using a hands-free thing here. But you know, otherwise I'd look it up. But I do remember. You know, I have probably at least a dozen or more Neil Young albums. He comes out with one about every week or two. So I really can't keep up. he really does. Even to this day, he comes out with an album every other week. But I just cannot. With that man, but you know, I have at least a dozen or more of his albums, but one of them I skipped was I think it came out shortly after 9/11, maybe 2002. I think it was called Are You Passionate, and it supposedly had a song on, well, it had a song on it called Let's Roll, which honestly I don't know if I've ever heard, but from reading reviews of it, it didn't sound quite as bad as Toby Keith's you know, the Boot in Your Ass song.
Yeah, but what does?
Well, I understand that's not being very generous saying it's probably not as bad as that, but I'm just saying, I don't know if it's as bad as that, but it from what I read, it sounded like it was, you know, a bit jingoistic, you know, and I don't know, it just didn't sound like it would be my thing, so I kind of skipped that album in favor of, you know, some of his output that sounded more interesting, did he actually make comments to the effect of, you know, George Bush being, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread and our savior and we should all bow down to him? I'm just wondering where you're getting that from.
I'm getting, the Let's Roll is part of it.
Okay. See, I don't even know if I've heard that.
And there were, and you know, I have been long, long, long a reader of Bart Kopp.
Yeah.
And you know, Bart Kopp will play with things, but when it comes to something like this, he won't say somebody is something that they aren't. And
yeah.
I remember back in the day, and I would it would just drive me nuts to even try to search Bart Kopp's archives. But I remember him. I swear, I think I do remember him. Having pull quotes of very pro-Bushy statements made by Neil Young.
Okay. Well, I mean, it is good that he came around at some point. I'll have to look at, like I said, I'm driving right now, but I'll have to look that up. I'm just kind of curious. But no, it couldn't have lasted too long. He must have came around to his senses, because I know by 2004 he was touring, you know, in support of MoveOn.org and in support of Carrie. I remember seeing.
Yeah, and then, you know, by 2006, he comes out with Living with War.
Right, with Let's Impeach the President. And, you know, there was a lot of other stuff on there that was very directly anti-Bush. Very, you know, very specific references to Bush. And that was 06. But even by 04, he had come around. Because, I mean, I was at one of the shows where he... it was actually a Pearl Jam show, and he made a surprise appearance during the encore and played about 30, 40 minutes with them. And, he, you know, he said, I'm here for Canadians for Kerry or something like that. So I don't know that he ever actually supported Bush in an election, but yeah, I'll have to check out those quotes. See, I didn't know that, other than, like, that Let's Roll thing, I just didn't know that he had actually made comments in support of Bush. I'll defer to Bart Kopp on that.
It's entirely possible I'm putting words in Bart Kopp's mouth.
Well,
but once I see somebody coming out and saying something Bushy,
yeah,
it tends to stick in my brain like a leech.
No, I understand. Yeah,
especially if it's somebody I respect and care about. But no, he did rehabilitate himself. There's no doubt about that.
Right. He came back around. I wasn't familiar with that. The Let's Roll thing, I think I have read, like I said, I don't even know if I've heard that track, but because it just didn't sound interesting to me.
It was more than a little bit about Flight 93.
No, right, yeah, I know. But I mean, that's where the quote, that's what the title comes from.
The alleged quote.
Right. But you know, I think I had, you know, even read over the years where he sort of tried to come back and, you know, defend that, you know, saying, well, you know, everybody thought that was, you know, like a Toby Keith kind of deal, but, you know, I was, you know what I mean? I was just...
Yeah, he's backing out of it.
Patriotic. It wasn't jingoistic, it was patriotic, you know, but the one thing I was going to say was, other than, if you put Let's Roll aside, the thing that I had always heard about him was that he had said some pro-Reagan things in the early 80s.
I think there's that as well.
Okay, but then, I mean, he came around on that, too, because, I mean, you know, there's songs like, you know, Rockin' in the Free World or whatever that, you know, sort of directly attack, you know, Bush, Bush.
Right, that everybody got except the Bushies, or except the Repiglicans.
Right. So yeah, I don't know. He must have sort of this caveman thing about him. Well, he kind of looks like a caveman anyway, but you know, he must have this sort of caveman thing in him where he occasionally regresses into these fits of right wingism or something. But I don't know. At least he comes back around eventually.
You just hope he stays around.
Yeah. Well.
But you know, a lot of people were seduced, and that's the thing. To anybody who doesn't have a grounding in history and in policy, it's real easy to be seduced by jingoistic hoopla. And you know, whether it was Ronald Reagan's it's morning in America, or whether it was George W. Bush's Let's Roll. It's easy for people to be seduced.
And especially if you think about it as a songwriter, it's probably pretty easy to write songs using that sort of imagery.
Yeah, they sort of write themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
Look at the boot in your ass song.
Yeah. But I don't know. I'll have to see what these egregious comments are. But you know, I can kind of forgive him for that. I didn't want you to leave it there and have people thinking, you know, that he was still some kind of loyal Bushy. Because, I mean, he must have reformed himself pretty quick. Because I remember seeing him, like I said, in 04, you know, supporting Kerry. But the other thing I was thinking was it seems like,
Well, first of all, Michael, let me just say that I credit the Horn audience to be able to sort things out for themselves. So I don't think I'm really leaving stuff hanging.
No, I know. Well, it just kind of felt like that to me, but that's sort of a topic that's near and dear to, you know.
No, I get it. No, certainly.
But I have this theory, and I don't know. I mean, like I said, I'll defer to Bart Kopp until I do my own research, or you do and send me a link, either way. But, you know, I'll defer to what you remember reading on Bart Kopp. But just in general with, you know, Neil Young or whoever it is, I kind of have this theory that I think I discussed it with you off the air. I have this theory that when it comes to rock and roll, you know, right wingers just don't have any cool musicians.
No, they've got Ted Nugent.
Yeah, they got Ted Nugent. You know, that's about it. So I just have this theory that, you know, if any rock musician, you know, ever in their, you know, like my whole theory with Rush, I'm not saying that Neil Peart, you know, is some kind of, you know, raging liberal, but, you know, back in the 70s when he was, you know, in his early 20s, you know, smoking dope all the time. And that's, I mean, that's not me just making stuff up. I mean, they got songs about it. But, you know, he's a, you know, a young kid, you know, just starting out in rock and roll. And, you know, and he read some kind of book by Ayn Rand, you know. And, you know, now for the next 35 years, it just seems like all, you know, all the right wingers, they like to dismiss everything he's written since then and try to claim him as one of their own. And I see that with other artists too. If they ever make some kind of comment or anything, they're forever branded. And the reason I say that is because I remember with Neil Young, I remember, reading, I don't know why, but sometimes rock journalists like to, around election time, like to compile these lists of, you know, the top 10 Democratic, you know, musicians, top 10 Republican musicians, whatever. I don't know why, you know, like music critics would want to like go out of their element like that, but they're usually these really badly researched lists. And I remember seeing in 04, or it might have been 04, maybe it was 08, but I remember seeing Neil Young on one of those lists of Republicans. And it just blew my mind because, you know, I was like, well, no, I just saw him at a Pearl Jam concert last week, you know, telling people to vote for Kerry. So I don't think he's going to be telling people to vote. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
And what I think it is, it's lazy music. It's lazy, you know, writers or bloggers or whatever who, you know, they just don't do the research. You know, if Neil Young did make, and I'm not excusing it, but if he did make a few pro-Bushy comments that are egregious, those are going to get repeated and reposted over and over and over again, you know, on Free Republic and wherever, by righties who are just desperate to say, see, they're not, you know, not all the good musicians are you know, lefties. You know what I mean? They'll ignore everything else, you know, whether it's whoever it is. They'll ignore everything else the musician has ever done or said, but they'll just, you know, keep reposting, you know, one or two comments. And then, you know, some lazy critic for a magazine is trying to make a list and trying to desperately find a few Republican musicians so that they can compile two lists. And, you know, someone like Neil Young or someone like Neil Peart ends up on the, Republican list when... Do you see where I'm going with that?
Yes. You don't trust right-wingers who say, no, he's mine.
Right. So...
No, I didn't think the Neil Young thing would light people would light up this issue so much as it would have, you know, whether there was a relationship between him and Lynyrd Skynyrd or whatever. But no, I get it.
Well, yeah, but isn't that? I mean, the Lynyrd Skynyrd thing's kind of pretty well
documented. You know. Yeah.
That's another topic I want to talk to you about sometime. I don't know if it's a good on-air or off-air topic. You know, because I know that, you know, the truckers are obviously influenced by, and, you know, I have a lot of respect for Skynyrd, and, you know, so did Neil Young, you know, so, you know.
You know what's blowing me away, speaking to the truckers, and I'm going to stay up to watch this.
The Squidbillies?
The Squidbillies thing.
Yeah.
I just love the idea that the truckers are playing on the Squidbillies musical.
See, I was wondering what you thought of that. I have mixed feelings about Squidbillies.
I love Squidbillies. I just do.
I sometimes, you know, don't know, you know, as far as, you know, I'm not a Southerner, but, you know, let's just say for a moment I was one. Sometimes I watch the Squidbillies and I'm not sure when they're, you know, when is it laughing with us and when is it laughing at us, you know what I mean?
I do, but... See, Agnes hates it.
Yeah.
Me, I love it. And frankly, look, I'm a simpleton, okay?
Yeah.
I got a little affirmation out of seeing the truckers playing on the Squidbillies musical, because apparently they're in on the gag. Because
yeah.
The Patterson and Cooley and the crew are not going to do something. No.
Right.
If this was all a big joke on us ignorant rednecks, I'm not thinking the boys would be involved. But maybe right. I'm treating the truckers as a religious shrine, which I'm, of course, guilty of doing.
Right. Oh, yeah, like anything they do, yeah, it's okay because it's the truckers. No, I don't think so. I mean, I
watched enough of the Squidbillies to feel like I'm watching somebody. I don't know. It's like a lot of people viewed Andy Griffith, Green Acres, the Beverly Hillbillies, Ma and Pa Kettle, all of that stuff as making fun of hillbillies.
Yeah.
But you'll notice that it's always the hillbillies who win in the end.
Yeah.
By their wits and their determination and the fact that they're smarter than the city slickers.
Yeah.
You know, I played that Ma and Pa Kettle do math thing a few weeks ago, as part of an overall the bit, and it's full of them.
Yeah.
You know, Jethro Bodine coming home from the Brando set. Uncle Jed, you know what we need? Motivation. I was just over at the Brando set, and they're just swimming in it. Motivation. And that's during an era of self-important, self-deluding actors. You know, okay, it's hot outside, so I have to imagine that I am a piece of bacon frying on it. Okay, I'm ready for my scene! You know, we need Uncle Jed motivation. They're just swimming in it over on the Brando set. When, if you know anything about Marlon Brando, you know that he would literally tape his movie lines or he would tape his movie lines to the backs of other people and read them. Motivation. The fact that Dash Riprock, you know, the Rock Hudson parody caricature in the Beverly Hillbillies. His former name before he was discovered as a truck driver was Homer Noodleman. It's not a parody on hillbillies. It's a parody of how the world responds to us.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, no, I mean, as far as Squidbillies go, I just
Mr. Haney on Green Acres?
Yeah.
Mr. Haney's not a clown. Mr. Haney's a sharp one.
Yeah.
And it's the constant struggle of Oliver Wendell Douglas Jr. to keep up with the Mr. Haney's and the Sam and Ralph, the painters and the Mr. Druckers. His constant struggle to understand their otherwise sane world.
But to your point, if you watch the Squidbillies, who are the sharp ones on there? You know what I mean? That's where I sometimes think it. I do think sometimes that show crosses the line of taste as far as.
Oh God, help me! I just love Granny on her walker.
Yeah, I like Early's hats. I got to say that.
Yeah, how can you not?
I just love his hats, but. Anyway,
but that, you know, but that also comes from my from that place in my soul, spirit, whatever have you, where we can laugh amongst ourselves.
Yeah.
Because frankly, no matter how frustrated I get, I love the people of my region. I genuinely do. You know, even the guy down to the convenience store who tells me, well, I'd just be happy if they'd close that NASA down because all they've been trying to do for years is prove that God don't exist. And you know, he was as earnest. He was as earnest as the day is long.
Yeah.
And frankly, you know, you hear things like that. That you know what the little experience I had where I used the word myth to describe creation, and yeah. Everybody was waiting for the lightning bolt to strike me. And you realize, you know, this has been created. This is a product. This is a created state. My own forebears. I was talking about Sam Black a little bit ago. We had a discussion of David Hume. I think I mentioned this on Friday night show, Michael. We had a discussion of David Hume. My multi-great grandfather was the first person to publish David Hume in Scotland. By the time his progeny had been three generations in America, they were all illiterate. And I can't, you got to bask in irony like that. And the constant struggle inside my family to crawl back up. And yet here I am, the multi-great-grandson of a publisher. And, you know, people will crawl across ground glass to get an Alexander Kincaid Bible. I'd love to have one someday. But the notion that we have scrabbled and struggled. And that love for learning and that love for reading has has to exist on a genetic level.
Sure.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so I tend to overanalyze, and you know, I just love the hell out of Squidbillies. I just do. Just the same way that I love the Aqua Teen Hunger Force. Although that's gotten kind of uneven lately, but the early ones, my God, you couldn't beat it.
Yeah. Hey, can I go back to a topic from earlier?
Sure.
Skinner, I don't know if this is a good on-air topic or off-air topic, but put it, the Neil Young thing aside, yeah, most, I suppose, maybe I, you know, I don't give the Horn audience enough credit. Sorry, guys, you know, yeah, they're probably aware of, you know.
And I may be totally wrong, and I get called on stuff that I screw up all the time.
Oh, no, I wasn't calling you on it. I was just saying, even if it was true, I know it.
No, but I'm saying the Horn family will not tolerate any bullshit from me.
Right, but you know what I mean. I was just saying that even if it was true, he's not still loyal Bushy. It was at best maybe a 1 or 2 year temporary fit of insanity that he, you know, came around full circle.
A lot of people were scared to death by what happened on September 11th, 2001.
Right. Right, and in a way, I mean, I can kind of forgive him.
You know, not everybody, not all of us sat here and thought, oh, my God, we're going to light the world up over this.
Right.
A lot of us did, but not all of us.
But, but the Skinner thing, not so much that I think I pretty well understand, you know, the relationship with Neil Young and all that, but, you know, I'm not quite sure what to make of Skinner, and I got to, you know, just I want to plead my ignorance, but I don't know how big of a fan you are. But I mean, I know they've turned into big time right wingers, but at the same time, there aren't really any original members anymore, are there?
You know, maybe a couple, and they're squabbling amongst themselves. I really haven't followed them. No, I mean, for me, Skinner ends with the plane crash. Just
right. I mean, but I mean, you know, so I can dismiss anything, you know, that's come out since then with the label Skynyrd on it. I mean, unless it's like a reissue or something, you know, I can.
No, but you know, if you think about, for instance, to work this, my God, how did we get here? To work the Skynyrd Neil Young parallel, Neil Young does Needle and Damage Done.
Right.
Right. Skynyrd arguably translates that into something that rednecks can understand and does Needle in the Spoon.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, Saturday Night Special is not a song in praise of firearms.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know, these are biting, trenchant commentaries on the I spent too long in the classroom on the proletarian struggle of the southern working class.
Right. See, and that's the thing. Like you mentioned Saturday Night Special. I in doing research for my show, you know, I was kind of, you know, I have all these different ideas. You know, someday I'll do a show with all a bunch of songs about this topic, or someday I'll do, you know, that kind of thing. And I, you know, one of my little secret plans in my head is someday I'll do a gun show. It'll just be all, you know, Second Amendment, you know, all the way. I don't know. Maybe it'll just be one side of the show. Maybe 1 hour. I don't know if I can pull together 2 hours, but it'll all be songs about, you know,
firearms.
And I'm thinking, you know, but obviously with my own particular slant. You know,
everybody run, the homecoming queen's got a gun. Yeah.
Right. It, you know, and Saturday Night Special seems like the perfect song for that. Whereas, you know, I think just a year or two ago, there's a Skynyrd song out, you know, which is, you know, very pro-gun, you know, pro, you know, from the right wing standpoint. You know,
yeah.
That's not something I would touch with a 10-foot pole, but. You know, like you said, they kind of die with the plane crash. But I'm kind of wondering, you know, even back then, you know, I know they're friends with Neil Young and all that, but I've never quite been able to sort of make sense of them. Like, to be perfectly honest, you know, just the whole thing with, you know,
Michael, if you will pardon a little bit of reverse snobbery, it's because you're not a redneck.
Say that again.
It's because you're not a redneck.
Right. But you know what I mean? Like the whole thing with the, you know, the Confederate flag and all that. I just honestly, when I was, yeah, because exactly, I'm not, you know, I'm from the North, and growing up, you know, I heard some of their songs on the radio and I just couldn't get into it. And then honestly, it wasn't until, well, to be quite honest, it wasn't until Drive By Truckers that I really gave any Southern rock a chance per se. You know, I mean, unless you count something like REM, but you know, I they're just sort of,
that's incident. So not Southern rock.
Right, they're just sort of incidentally from the South. You know what I mean? It's, you know, they just kind of happen to be from Georgia. But,
yeah.
But it, you know, it's not the same thing. But you know what I mean? What someone would characterize as Southern rock, I really didn't even give it a chance until Drive-By Truckers. And I didn't even give the Drive-By Truckers a chance, having read good reviews of them, until I just heard it on your show. You know what I mean? I kind of was like, yeah, well, they get good reviews, but, you know, it's Southern rock. So, yeah, I'm kind of a snob. So, but the Skynyrd thing, I was kind of pleased, or felt, I guess, a little bit of affirmation when I read in the liner notes to Southern Rock Opera that Patterson wasn't really that into Skynyrd either when he was, you know, a young man. He kind of really didn't get it. He didn't really understand it until later.
Well, you know, I mean, there's that lyric, you know, I never saw Lynyrd Skynyrd, but I did see Molly Hatchet.
Right.
I was too young to have seen Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Right. But not just, but I mean, I think he kind of goes on to say that, you know, there were people, in his high school that loved Skynyrd.
And yeah, for all the wrong reasons.
Right. So...
You know, it was an ass-kicking brand of rock and roll, and there were a lot of people that didn't bother to listen to the lyrics.
Right. But
play that Saturday Night Special again.
Right.
Dang, wish I had me one then.
Right. Oh,
yeah,
man,
did you hear that? Did you hear that Needle in the Spoon song? They say it's got to be cool because they say you take a trip to the moon.
Hey, Bob, you just gave me a connection with your little play that Saturday Night Special again with the accent there. That's two songs. I just thought of a song I could connect to that. I could play Saturday Night Special, and then I think I'm going to have to check. I think it's Nirvana's In Bloom, where one I think it's the chorus is he's the one who likes our pretty songs and likes to shoot his gun. Or I think it says likes to shoot his gun, likes our pretty songs, but don't know what it means.
Right, and David in Tennessee told me that
about Saturday Night Special.
David in Tennessee told me a fascinating story about a band he knew up in the Great Northwest that was like in many ways a mother band to later movements. A punk band called Poison Idea that had skinheads and Nazis and crap showing up for their shows.
Yeah.
And they took a very, very gutsy position and wrote a song directly for those thugs, punks, and assholes.
Right.
Telling them, you know, in no uncertain terms, we're not that.
Right, right. Yeah, I remember David, I don't know if he told you about it on the air or if I read an essay on Billy Shears' old website, but yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was for Billy Shears. Hey, Michael, I got to roll along, brother, but fun conversation. You never know where this stuff's going to take you. I just got an email from Cindy listening in the Great Northwest with a link to IMDb and the Squidbillies saying, is this what you're talking about? Yeah, that's them. And, of course, the clip opens with Granny, you know, sitting there hanging Squidly on the walker.
Sure. Yeah, that's a real high-class show.
Oh, it is. Anybody who goes to Adult Swim for enlightenment, well, you know. You know, for me, it's what's on at midnight when I'm trying to fall asleep. And then Agnes is next to me going, I can't believe you're watching this.
Yeah.
But, no, the clip there, you know, and he's wearing the hat and support our troops.
All right, I'll let you go, Bob. You have a good evening.
All right, take care, Michael. Bye now.
You too. Bye.
And we roll onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jim, what's up?
How are you?
Well, but tired.
Well, and deservedly so. My congratulations on your history program, and also best wishes on your trip to Las Vegas.
Well, thank you. All the credit in the world for what happened at Concord goes exclusively to Dr. Bill.
Well, he's a very fine man.
Yes, he is.
There's just something on my mind that I wanted to share, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You know, and I've been thinking about this an awful long time. I really have. And it touched back on Mel Gibson's racism and his bigotry, and I don't understand the mindset of an individual of that nature. And I don't think I really want to understand it. But touching back on one thing I heard back in 1988, Jesse Jackson said that 1988 Democratic Convention. I may have grown up in the slums, but the slums did not grow up in me. And that touched me very personally, because I grew up in an area of the country filled with bigotry and racism, but it did not grow up in me.
There you go. Nor I. Not to steal your thunder, but nor I. And that's the... If there is a grand mistake that the rest of the country makes about the South, Jim, it is the tendency to view the South as so-called solid South, or just utterly uniform, no differentiation. That's why I've said for a long time that the liberals who live and fight and struggle in the South, they know a brand of necessary courage and bravery that many of us elsewhere will never know.
Well spoken.
Because you can still get a cross burnt in your yard for nothing more than your politics.
Well, that happened in my own situation when I grew up in Camden, South Carolina. But there are two African Americans, and if I were to delineate the contributions of African Americans we'd be here all night. But there are two that I would like to honor tonight, if I may.
Certainly.
The first is Joe Louis. That man did a hell of a lot for this country. I mean, he was used by the Army. I mean, he fought Max Schmeling in 1936 before Schmeling beat him Max 15 rounds. And, of course, after that, Schmeling was Hitler's darling. But in 1938, in less than, what, one or two rounds, Joe Louis took Schmeling right out.
Right. It was almost like a rigged fight.
Joe Louis went on to endure a very hard life. In many cases, made very difficult by the Internal Revenue Service. They just would not leave him alone. I mean, for all his services during the war, he was virtually given no credit whatsoever and was almost hounded to death by the Internal Revenue Service and people who just didn't want the idea of the black people having a hero. And I know a guy that I talk to every day in Columbia, South Carolina, Mr. Oscar Shaw, who knew Joe Louis, and he used to caddy for him at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And I've talked with Oscar many times about what happened to Joe Louis. And here's the thing, you know, Joe Louis ended up in a state of virtual penury, whereas Max Schmeling, who was Hitler's champion, of course, Hitler threw him under the bus, put him in the army, but Schmeling survived. But later became a spokesman for the Coca-Cola company. Max Schmeling ended up a millionaire. Joe Louis ended up a beggar and was only saved and given medical treatment paid for by Frank Sinatra.
Didn't know that.
And the other is Josephine Baker.
Certainly.
And I invite you to read her biography called The Hungry Heart. A little girl whose youth was ravaged by race riots and things of that nature. But yet she went on and had to leave this country, went to France, and took that nation by storm. And during the war, fighting for our troops, she couldn't have children, but she had, excuse me, thirteen adopted children from all races. Calling them her rainbow tribe.
I wonder if that was the first use of rainbow, Jim. Within that context.
I don't know.
Beautiful. Well, if you would not mind, I will add one more to that list. Because he left this planet a couple of days ago. At the age of 90. Vernon Baker.
Oh, yeah.
He was sent to Italy with a full platoon of 54 men on April 5th. He and his soldiers found themselves behind enemy lines near Viareggio, Italy.
Right.
When concentrated enemy fire from several machine gun emplacements stopped his company's advance, Baker crawled to one and destroyed it, killing three Germans. Continuing forward, he attacked an enemy observation post and killed two occupants. Only under the administration of Bill Clinton was Vernon Baker awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. And the Defense Department made that late award because they made a determination that he was denied the Medal of Honor for no other reason than race.
Exactly.
He was 90 years old and died of complications of brain cancer.
When I was in D.C., I had the opportunity to go to Bowling Air Force Base to meet the remnants of the Tuskegee Airmen. I'll never forget that time. But, I mean, Josephine Baker did so much to glorify our own country in its time of struggle and showed her humanity for people who had no home, those children whom she adopted.
Yes.
She, too, died in penury and was only rescued from penury by Princess Grace.
Sometimes a little bit of that noblesse bubbles to the top, doesn't it?
Well,
you know, you mentioned early on, Jim, about what Jesse Jackson said. I'm reminded you've heard Cassie on the program from time to time, correct?
Yeah.
She wrote me an email a little bit ago when I had mentioned the fact that the uprising that led to the assault on the Alamo by Mexican forces had to do with slavery. This is history. This is real. The American settlers who were settling Texas wanted to own slaves. And they had an issue with General Santa Ana because Mexico, unlike the United States, had long before taken the enlightened step of abolishing slavery within its borders, which Texas fell into at the time. And lo and behold, Cassie wrote to me a little bit ago, and you know what a good student she's been. She's been a superior student.
Oh, yes, wise beyond her years.
And she writes me this email, and she says, what does slavery have to do with the Alamo? And so, because I'm in the middle of stuff, I just wrote back very briefly, the Alamo happened because the Texan settlers wanted to keep slaves while the Mexican government had abolished it. And she writes back, and this is the stunning part. You know, we had the discussion about the Texas School Board Book Standards Committee, you know, throwing Thomas Jefferson out and inserting Phyllis Schlafly instead, that kind of crap. Well, here's the living proof of the danger of that kind of politicization of history. Cassie wrote back to me, Jim, and she said, I had 2 years of Texas history. And they never mentioned it. Never mentioned it.
That's very sad. It really is. And, you know, tonight my voice has been broken because my eyes are filled with tears. They really are. Having read Josephine Baker's biography, The Hungry Heart, and having seen a recent documentary about Joe Lewis, not to mention the other so many other African-Americans who were not given credit.
Consider Jack Johnson.
Bob, the list is in.
It is.
But the only thing I can say, and I'm going to get off here and let other people get on here, as far as my tears are concerned, there's an old Indian saying, my friend, the soul will have no rainbows if the eyes have no tears.
Lovely. Lovely, Jim. Have a good evening, my friend.
Good night, sir.
Take care. Bye now. Jim never calls the program, but he doesn't bring something profound and good to the conversation. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Have a good evening, my friend.
Good night, sir.
Take care. Bye now.
That sounds like me. Hello?
Hello?
Hello.
Hey.
Hey, Juanita, what's up?
I just came back on because I was listening to Jim, and I'd like to say something about Joe Lewis.
Please do.
To add to that, and I'm sure Jim knows, he had to resort to wrestling
Yeah, professional wrestling.
Back then, and that what wrestling wasn't like it is now, you know, kind of a little more respected. That was kind of, he had to humble himself. And he, I don't think he ever got out of it.
I don't know, but, yeah, what a horror.
Yeah, and I remember his wife went on there, some kind of quiz show back then, and she went on to try to win money to help pay for it, you know, because the interest was exorbitant on those things. And they would lose everything. I'll tell you who else lost, too, was, remember Abbott and Costello?
Sure.
Costello went through that. And then later on, Abbott went through that. And, you know, just lost pretty much everything they had, you know, that they thought they were set for life. And so, anyway, but, well, I tell you who I admire in history, the more I know about him, is George Washington Carver.
Gosh, yes.
I mean, you know, now the South could have been like the Dust Bowl if it weren't for him.
Just keep planting that cotton, keep burning up that soil.
Yeah. But, and you were weren't you talking about liking somebody even though they've got, you don't like their politics?
Probably. I bet it won't come to me right off the top of my head.
Well, was that the guy that was calling before Jim, was he the one that's got the new show?
No. Before Jim, Michael? Michael?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, Michael's got the People's Mixtape on Saturday nights at 7 p.m.
I really enjoy that show.
Well, there won't be one this Saturday because Michael is on the road, but it'll be back the other part of it being we're not going to be here to run it.
I heard talking about Rush's, not Rush Limbaugh, but Rush's lead composer, I guess you call him, the drummer.
Neil Peart?
Yeah. About him, you know, liking Ann Ryan. Do you know a lot of people don't like him? I was telling my son, because my son's a big Rush fan. And he knows, and he said that, you know, that he was, it was just one of the things he went through that he, you know, he got some what he could out of it, you know. He wasn't that. He's more like a philosopher. But anyway, I thought it was interesting that he played that, and then I could tell my son about it. And my son, like, know all the words to all the songs. And but anyway, my person, and you're just going to flip over this, I'm sure, because you know I love George Michael.
Yes, I do.
But, I mean, I'm eclectic in my music. And my favorite country performer, although I hate his politics. And
please don't say Toby Keith. Please don't say Toby Keith.
Oh, no. Uh-uh.
Okay.
And no, I don't think he's that bad, but maybe. But anyway, I didn't know that he was like that until after I became a fan. But Charlie Daniels.
Well, yeah. By the way, Charlie is playing at the big Friends of Coal rally coming up later. Yeah, he's going to come up and play the fiddle while Don Blankenship blows up our mountains. Talk about fiddling while Rome burns, huh?
Yeah. But, you know, he's the only one that I paid to go see, the only country star I paid to go see, but that was at a festival. You know, it wasn't like a hall or anything.
Right.
But I thoroughly enjoyed it. But, you know, just because I'm sure some of the people that we like, some of the authors that we like, we would hate their, you know, from the years ago, we would hate their politics. And, you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
But anyway, does he take requests on there?
You can email him, yes.
Okay. Anyway, I wanted to say a little something about our politics down here.
Okay.
I met a lady the other day. I didn't know the census workers were still working. And we've got these crazy addresses out here, and they're having to try to get them straightened out. And see, I've lived out here a long time, except when I was married, and then lived like other places. But so I know a lot about these lots. For one, my daddy used to own a bunch of them, and he either gave them away or sold them really cheap, you know, to help people. But anyway, she was black, and I got to talking politics with her. And she liked Hillary. She said she thought Hillary would have been really good. But we were talking about how, you know, now they're coming out and saying, you know, black people can't handle things the way white people can. They can't govern, or they can't be in charge of anything. And I said, these people are just racist. And she said, that was right. And I said, but I told her, I said, some of the people that are running now, not just here in Florida, if we get them in, we're going to have to do a whole lot of laughing to keep from crying.
Well, Lord of mercy.
And we're going to have to.
Have you seen the carrying on that the right wing is doing over the fact that the NAACP came out and said,
yeah,
look, let's face it, the teabaggers are racists?
Have you heard Sarah?
No. Oh, no.
Oh, no. This is such a wonderful thing.
No, what
wonderful.
Did, you got, well, what did Caribou Barbie say?
They're so wonderful. It's such a wonderful. They're not racist. Well, happy day if they're not. And I'm thankful that the NAACP. I'm glad they came out.
I'm glad they called them out too.
And,
of course, then again, it's nothing we haven't been saying for months. I'm glad.
Oh yeah, we knew. We knew. But yeah, and then that billboard out there, you know, with the saying he's Hitler and.
Oh yeah, that's a real precious moment. Putting up a billboard, the North.
Yeah.
What is it? The North Iowa Teabaggers. I mean, Tea Party. A picture of Lenin, a picture of Obama,
racist.
And a picture of Hitler. But no, that's not.
But that's not racist.
No.
And then when they were up there spitting on some of our congressmen, some who've been beaten up.
They would have spit on white people twice as hard.
And they, and Cindy Sheehan just stepped on the right crack, and she's going to have to go to trial for that. You know, she got arrested like 5 minutes after she got there in Washington the same day.
I'll be darned.
And then, they're going to have to, you know, to go and have a trial up there. They were supposed to have it here a while back, but I don't know what they put it off or something. I haven't read the whole details, but I get emails from her.
Juanita, I got to share something with you.
Okay.
I got an email earlier today from Sandra.
Uh-huh.
And I thought immediately of you, because this is a conversation that you and I have had on a number of occasions.
Okay.
It comes from Huffington Post, and it's one of those lo and behold kind of moments. Because it's so interesting to see what happens, or to see the rest of the world catching up with what we already know.
Yeah.
And it's a post from Sam Stein at Huffington Post.
Uh-huh.
And Sandra sends this thing along to me, and she says with it, "This is my nightmare and a really good reason to keep the passport updated."
And, yeah.
And what this post is from over at Huffington Post, Sam Stein, headline, "The Bush Revival, How Jeb, Rove, Gillespie Are Leading the GOP Again." And he gets down here.
Oh, boy.
Well, let me just share a couple of paragraphs with you, because it's going to make profits out of the both of us.
Yeah.
It starts out and says, "Simon Rosenberg is the most bullish of Democratic strategists. The former Clinton administration official and head of the young nonprofit group NDN has been the chief proponent of the belief that Barack Obama's election produced the opportunity for what he calls a, quote, 30 to 40 year era of Democratic dominance." Wow, he is an optimist. But anyway, going on, he says, a specialist in the political habits of different demographic groups, specifically Hispanics, he insists that absent a drastic makeover, the GOP risks cementing itself as irrelevant to the 21st century. But, you know, wait, there's a punchline. Sagging poll numbers and policy setbacks have done little to dissuade these rosy prognostications. There's only one thing that makes Rosenberg nervous. Another Bush. And here's the quote from Simon Rosenberg. Jeb is married to a Latina.
Yeah.
Is fluent in Spanish. Speaks on Univision as a commentator. His Spanish is that good.
Uh-huh.
Rosenberg said of the former Florida governor and brother to the 43rd president during a lunch at NDN headquarters last week, quote, and if you look at the electoral map in 2012, you have to assume that Obama is going to have a very hard time in holding North Carolina and Virginia. The industrial Midwest, where the auto decline has been huge, has weakened Obama's numbers a great deal. So Ohio, Michigan, and Indiana and Wisconsin become a bit more wobbly. So if you're Barack Obama, the firewall is the Latin belt from Florida to southwestern California, and there is only one Republican who can break through that firewall, and it is Jeb.
Yeah. He's sticking his toes in big time.
Donna Brazile was interviewed for the article. She said, Jeb has the talent, the experience, and the ability to rebuild the GOP's tent. Stanley Greenberg, a Democratic pollster, said, I believe Jeb Bush could run. He is more of a genuine conservative than Romney. Bush is a big hangover, but not impossible.
Oh, no, it's not impossible. Because people say, well, you know, he's a smart one. But, you know, talking about him now.
And so, but by the same token, let's remember, Jeb Bush is a Bush. And that means he's so daggum crooked, they're going to have to screw him into the dirt when he dies.
My governor, you know, for 8 years. But he's more deceptive, you know. You can catch on to Bush, you know, George a little quicker if you've got any, you know, insight at all. But with him, he can fool you because he is well-spoken. But I was going to say that one of the men that is running for a senator down here, one of the Democrats, Kindred Meek, he's one of the ones that went into Jeb's office, outer office, when he was in the governor. And him and another congressman, you know, here from Florida. And that's the ones where Bush was, you know, they were trying to do with affirmative action, which he did down here in the schools. And anyway, he said, get their A's out of here. Well, I had that on tape. I've got the article. I did have it on tape. And that's his favorite saying. But he claimed then later that he was talking about the reporters that were in there. But they were in there, they were trying, you know, to, like a sit-in protest. And there was people, it looked like for miles, up there protesting against that bill. And he never spoke to any of them. He just went ahead and did his thing. And I don't know. I don't know, Bob. And he is, you know, he's for the Rubio.
Right, right.
Right now he's two instead of one. And I can't actually believe that Meek is number three because we've got this other guy I told you about. He couldn't remember who he voted for. Supposed to be a Democrat. Jeff Green. And when I heard him on the TV, I was like, my gosh. But he claimed he can't remember who he voted for. Well, he ran for Republican congressman right at that time. But now he's got all the right words except there's a few things that he's saying something about immigration. But I mean, I got so much. I just wanted to say too about the other guy that's the running for Republican. He's the crook, you know, the one that his hospitals and all. He owns all these. It's kind of like.
Oh, yeah, and I can't remember his name right now.
Yeah, Burns, I think. Anyway, I mean, he looks real ghoulish. But
yeah, he looks like Montgomery Burns.
But anyway, he, you know, he wants the same thing. He wants the Arizona law here. And I'm kind of wishing they'd go ahead and let them have it over there, because I don't think I don't think people realize how horrible that's going to be.
You know, that's the problem, Juanita.
Intertwining things.
The people vote on slogans and not substance. And you know, as long as some right winger is saying, "I'm going to make you be proud to be a Florida American."
Yeah.
You know, well, that's good enough. You know, that's good enough for half of Florida.
No, and then you got to McConnell. He's suing to get rid of the medical care.
Sure.
And the other guy, you know, having run a hospital, you know, they know it all. So, I would like to hear some of the other people that live in Florida, if they have anything to talk about it.
All right. Well, you have put out the call. Juanita, have yourself.
The governor thing is really a mess.
Well, it is. And the thing is, all of this will get hotter and hotter as we get nearer November, and the Marco Rubio thing already is.
Yeah.
So you'll be hearing more, I have no doubt whatsoever.
Yeah.
Juanita, have yourself a wonderful evening,
you
and
too,
we will talk soon.
And when are you leaving?
We are leaving before the birds even wake up on Tuesday morning.
Oh, okay. I got in a little bit behind when you said, and I thought you were going to leave this weekend.
Oh, no. We are leaving early Tuesday morning, so we'll have shows tomorrow night and Monday night, and then it gets weird again.
Mm-hmm. Okie doke.
All right. You take care, Juanita.
Okay.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Listen. I listened to some of your history stuff. I love the actress. I don't know, remember her name. But
oh, Karen Varange.
Yeah, that was great. And so you did that for, what, the last week and a half?
Yeah, it started Tuesday a week ago and wound up last night.
Yeah, no, I didn't really catch a whole bunch of it, but I caught a couple of first days. I thought that was really interesting.
Well, as soon as Ben gets some tech problems sorted out, it'll all go up as the archives in the White Rose Society, maybe even under its own separate folder and our own separate link, because it's well worth the time. I mean, there was stuff there. Again, I miss sitting in a classroom. I miss that kind of exchange of ideas and discussion and that kind of stuff. All the stuff I didn't know, people like, for instance, John Kaminsky from Wisconsin, that guy is the guy, Sandra.
Mm.
He is the guy to speak to issues relating to the ratification of the Constitution. And I kid you not, he sat there one morning or afternoon or whatever, no emotion, no carrying on or anything, but just went about the business of peeling Antonin Scalia like a grape.
Mm. Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I remember reading that one article by Scalia when he's talking about interpreting the Constitution. It's just like, oh, dear God. So, yeah, that must have been interesting.
Oh, it was. I mean, among other things, he points out the fact that all of these guys, these vaunted founders, the framers, for God's sakes, they all had provisions, and but for a little bit of luck here and there, it could have happened. They all wanted their papers burned or not published for 100 years. So, and what Dr. Kaminsky said was, you know, at the end of the day, you can talk about original intent all you want to, but this was the walkaway statement. This was the home run in the bottom of the ninth with two out and the bases loaded. There is no original intent. And then he said, for every original intent that Scalia would cite, I can cite four the other way.
Scalia is always, you know, talked about as this brilliant blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, his whole analysis is so fucking simplistic. I'm sorry. It's just, it ain't even based in reality.
No, it's made up bull. It is ends-based rationalization to justify, you know, it's all done to justify where he wants to go with his sick, twisted political philosophy.
Yeah, exactly. No. It just is on, you can put it on the same pile as Strauss and all them people, you know, the allegory of the cave, all them people who think that, you know, things are designed from above, you see, and they just sort of frame it always with that in mind.
And I have to confess, I did think of you at one point when I think it was Dr. Tom Tierney who completely demolished the unseen hand of the market.
Oh, listen, back to the Constitution, though, but even Charles Beard, who wrote the economic reasoning for the Constitution, that's a brilliant book. Have you heard of that?
No.
Oh, no, it's fantastic. It was written in 1913, and he goes exactly, he takes apart the circumstances of the founders and looks at it from an economic point of view and just blows all the sort of warmness for man and liberty and stuff, just blows it out of the water and breaks down exactly what the Constitution was all about.
And that's what we, you know, we had a day and a half of Rousseau and Locke and Hume and Hobbes, and you come away with it going, wow, you know, because it had been a while since I had had any depth on that stuff. But you can't, you know, this warm fuzzy, get out the pipe and fife and drum corps, run the flag up the pole, you know, deify the framers. All you got to do is be exposed to a little bit of information on it, and that's all gone.
I don't know, and Locke in particular is interesting because they always try to deify him, but that fool was mainly concerned with property rights. Everything else was up for grabs with Locke, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The property right isn't sacrosanct. It's a means to organize an aspect of society. These people who talk about these people now, they have them locked in this sort of, I don't know what kind of case. But it doesn't make no sense. When you read Locke, you're like, oh, you know, he's just a practical man coming up with a way of organizing. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. And the same thing happens when you read Adam Smith.
No, Adam Smith is so—it's so sad because if you really do read that shit, it's so much more interesting, and he's so much more rational and insane about what's really going on than we've been fed.
And one of the things that was said was that things that he published before The Wealth of Nations and after The Wealth of Nations are every bit as important, if not more important, than The Wealth of Nations. Go find somebody at the Cato Institute to say that. Ain't gonna happen.
Because I remember studying, you know, Locke, and, you know, it's very interesting, but, you know, it's like his whole thought about property doesn't reach as far as the person. It stops there. It's like all of a sudden, what about my goddamn labor, Locke? Don't I own that? I mean, you can go off. It's very interesting, but, you know, there's a lot of ways to sort of look at the people who provided the Enlightenment, and, you know, God bless them, because they did sort of open things up for man on some levels, but, yeah.
Well, it was, you know, in many ways, it was these were tentative steps toward getting away from a social system that depended on a priesthood. That had, you know, anything that smacked of progress had to be blessed by a priest, which wasn't going to happen.
Yeah. No, you're right. And Rousseau, you know, is always interesting. But, you know, you get too deep into him, it becomes fairly authoritarian, I got to say, about Rousseau.
Oh, it does. It does. But, you know, I love...
I enjoyed the social contract. When he starts getting into that civil religion, I'm like, oh, boy, this is all getting a bit, you know, fascistic, but it's interesting.
It is very much so. And, you know, I love the comment that Dr. Tierney made about the fact that Hobbes's views on self-preservation. That you know, all this claptrap about how, you know, sacrificing yourself for the good of the state, blah blah blah. He thought it was all crap. And that's why this, when Civil War came to England, he said, later, boys, I'm getting on a boat.
Well, yeah, I mean, Hobbes is like all about this authority figure until your ass has to die. And then he says, my son, you can leave, which I always found hella funny with Hobbes. Also, with Hobbes and all them freaks, where the women at?
You know what? Ain't no women. Ain't no women.
So it becomes really problematic because it's like, hello.
And that's the thing that came out of all this. You know, a good half to two-thirds of the class that was listening to all this were women.
Yeah, well, the state of nature had women, Bob.
I think there were a few behind, you know, hiding in the bushes and back behind the trees, yeah.
Well, I understand, you know, what we're talking about is, you know, but I always thought, the thing about Hobbes is always like, dude, you know, I know your reality was kind of effed up because the time he lived in was hella turbulent, I guess, you know?
You got Cromwell out there running around.
Right.
You know, and that guy's a loony.
And everything was so tenuous, so of course he would, you know, lean more towards, well, yeah, you can pick your ruler, but goddamn it, it ain't never going to change.
Yeah, and I can pick a boat ticket, too.
Well, and it's just, I mean, and I hate how people use Hobbes as a basis for conservatism, because it's just like, oh, please, come on now. He got a lot going on, too.
And that was the beautiful thing. All of this stuff, and again, I thought of you when, to a couple of shocked gasps inside the classroom, he lays out Hobbes, and he lays out Locke, and he lays out Rousseau, and he lays out Hume, and he says, listen, in all these forms, we are talking about liberalism. And that's when we went, and that's when a few of our parts of the room went,
I know, poor liberalism. I mean, Jesus, that's been the word of the week, I guess. Because people have so many weird definitions of it, man. I can't keep up.
But, you know, the point made was that to the extent that all of this was a rather significant departure from the divine right of kings and the idea that, you know, God anoints the leader of the clan, the tribe, the nation, or the state, that when you start talking about social contract, you know, it doesn't have any women in it, that you are talking about liberal departures from the norm.
Well, and Rousseau actually attacked the rich, you know, which, of course, that's what gravitated me to that. I'm like, say what? You know, he went straight after the rich, and I'm like, oh, wow. So, yeah, that's where, you know, that's my thing about Rousseau, because he called it like it was from the get, which is all, you know, really. Because some of these other ones, I mean, Hobbes, you know, they still have severe deference for the power, you know, which is, I guess that makes sense since that's what they're writing about. But Rousseau was able to sort of, you know, identify the tensions.
You know, I love the fact that there were some early rumblings of rights for people who were otherwise dispossessed. You know, you've got northern states expanding the franchise beyond property holders. Again, men, white-skinned men who were property holders. And then, you know, early on, women, they do start talking about issues relating to women, but it will take, what is it? I think it's the early part of the 1800s. When Connecticut passes the first Married Women's Property Act, saying that women who brought property to a marriage that the husband did not have a right to take ownership of it.
Mm. Well,
it's all such a fits and starts and baby steps, and it's done in the framework of all of this high-minded thinking, and you're right, Sandra. How you do that without saying over there half the population. You know, the white population. And no. You know, you've got Jefferson who cares deeply for his children. You've got these beautiful letters written by Abigail Adams. And nobody stops along the way and says, shouldn't they vote?
Yeah, oh, I know. No, I mean, you know, but anybody with any sense, you get rumblings of that because it's just commonsensical. You can't have this expression of humanity and exclude people of color, Native Americans, and women. I mean, it was just logical extension. But, I mean, the U.S., you know, it was so big that you had different opportunities for, you know, to release the pressure valve, like you were talking about.
Yeah, I loved the fact that it was brought up that Jefferson said upon the completion of the Louisiana Purchase, we have provided living space for the United States to the 1,000th generation.
Yeah?
Yeah, how's that working out, Tom?
Yeah, my goodness. Well, listen, anyway, the reason why I called was I was like, you know, of course, what can I say? I'm like a sick person, but I was rolling. I was like, oh, no, the Negroes went off the ranch. They had lost their minds calling them crackers, what the hell they are. And these white people, about the heads are exploding. I mean, the NAACP called their asses racist, and they proceeded to do what? Be racist.
Yeah, wasn't it beautiful?
Yeah, you see the shit that's...
And they brought a black guy out to do it.
Oh, no, it's just like, oh, you had the Project 21 right-wing black group coming out. So you have, you know, they trying to pull out all the stops, but... Benjamin, whatever his name is it Jealous? Yeah, he's the head of the...
Yeah, Jealous.
Yeah, he called it what it was. And the thing is that the Tea Party, you know, the fact that they're like, I think their heads are exploding. They can't believe they've been called on this shit. They're racist.
And I mean, did you hear this apologia from Bishop E.W. Jackson? From the social conservative group Stand, they trotted him out, and called him on it. And Chris Jansing, the interviewer, said, "Well, according to Think Progress, a former Tea Party Express chairman, Mark Williams, and he, you know, he ran out and immediately did racist things upon being called a racist. It's beautiful."
Oh.
He said, Mark Williams called President Obama, quote, an Indonesian Muslim turned welfare thug and a racist in chief. He also called the Muslim god Allah, quote, a terrorist's monkey god. Are you comfortable with that, Bishop? And Bishop Jackson, who has been hauled out in the finest traditions of tokenism, says, well, first of all, nobody speaks for me. Isn't that one of those Nixonian non-admission admissions?
Listen, that's lawn jockey, house nigga. Sorry, I don't have no time. I'm like, you know what? Sit the hell down and shut the F up.
But I love where he goes next. This is precious, Sandra. And if you ask me, am I comfortable? And of course, nobody asked him this. And if you ask me, am I comfortable with everything that Al Sharpton said or Jesse Jackson said or any black conservative said, you'd probably find things I'd say, nah, that doesn't represent me. I'm a Republican. And I don't, and by the way, I don't agree with everything Michael Steele says. Got to get Michael Steele in there. It's a beautiful thing.
Well, no, but it's just sort of, I'm sorry. That's what they are. And, you know, they just seem to be just completely unhinged at the idea of the NAACP, which was founded by a bunch of white liberals. Thank you very much. I mean, I know there was a smattering of black people, but they was lynching folks too much for blacks to be doing too much.
So, oh, yeah.
Come on now. 1909, that's when it was founded. We know.
And you get the split between what? Booker T. Washington and W.E.B.
Yeah.
Du Bois.
Right, he did. He published The Crisis. You know, it was a big split, and they had multiple splits throughout the years. But funny enough, they're still here.
That much is true. Bishop Jackson's last comment is really the nail in the coffin. He says, the Tea Party's a broad movement, and people will sometimes say things that some of us won't disagree with, and that's a direct transcription. You know, Dr. Freud, your slip is showing. They will sometimes say things that some of us won't disagree with, or will disagree with. And then this, but the idea that the Tea Party movement is racist, or that it has racist elements that need to be denounced, is a nonsensical statement. So he's saying that he won't denounce that clown standing there with the sign that says N-I-G-G-A-R?
Or this Mark Williams who wrote, I quote, they make more money off of race than any slave trader ever.
Oh, that was a beautiful thing. That was just a couple of days ago.
No, and then he wrote some sort of mock letter to President Lincoln. asking for a return to slavery. Freedom means having to work for real, think for ourselves, and take consequences along with the rewards. That is just too much to ask us color people. We demand that it stops. And it just goes on and on. Hello?
That's mind-blowing. I didn't know that one.
Oh, listen. So it's just, you know, give me a break. I'm sort of like, I mean, part of me is like, I don't even care. It's like, this ain't no news to me.
No, and it's like what I said responding to your Huffington Post link and that I mentioned to Juanita.
Ugh.
In both of these things, you know, we knew this about the Tea Party a year ago. The Tea Baggers Tea Party, my ass.
No, exactly. And you were the one who talked about the Bush thing. That's why I sent that to you, because I was like, oh no, you know what I mean?
Right. So it apparently takes 2 years for me. It's like the Pony Express or something. It takes 2 years for me to say something here for it to filter down to Huffington Post. We got to work on that.
Well, and the other thing that's really getting to me is just the sort of disaster that is what's going on now. I mean, do you realize that this is like 10 years of like some sort of, it's just been a nightmare in this country for the last decade. Would you agree?
Oh, can't wake up.
I mean,
we're going to wet the bed sooner or later.
Well, let me give you a quick quote from this article I read in, you know, my favorite paper, the Financial Times. Okay, the quote is this by this sort of Clinton ex whatever official. Anyway, the bottom line here is that Americans don't believe in President Obama's leadership, says Rob Shapiro. He was a supporter of Mr. Obama. He has to find some way between now and November of demonstrating that he's a leader who can command confidence and, this is a kicker, short of a 9/11 event or an Oklahoma City bombing.
Oh.
I can't think of how he could do that. This is in the Financial Times. Are these people stupid? They sick. They're sick.
That is perverse. That is obscene, Sandra.
No, it's outrageous. I'm like, what the? You know what I'm...
Yeah, because it's Paul Wolfowitz all over again. It's PNAC all over again. Oh, well, all we need is another Pearl Harbor.
No, but this shit now is just sort of propagated straight up on the front page of the Financial Times as if it's common. It's horrible. I'm thinking, oh, my God. So, yeah, I just wanted to share that with you because I was so disturbed. You know, this goes unchallenged now. And I'm sitting here thinking, oh, wow, you know.
Well, I mean, he's got leadership issues, but to sit there and tie that up with a little prayer for a nice, tasty disaster. Excuse me? Gulf of Mexico? Anybody? Hello?
Yeah, it's all, and it's just, you know, it just is such a failure of governance. I don't know what's going on. And, you know, I'm done with the sort of blaming of Obama because, as you and me both can see, this is way beyond. I don't even know what's going on.
Is he out? I mean, is he out of his depth?
Well, this is, you know, I mean, I was sort of listening to Juanita talking. I don't know what she was saying. She was speaking to some black woman who's going on that. They're saying now, oh, you know, going to line it up with, oh, black people aren't able to govern. I was like, wow. I mean, I can imagine that meme can be popping out, too.
But is it, but okay, to run this back to deep baptism immersion in American history, isn't that just a further extension of the 400-year-long infantilization of the persons of color in this country, whether they be black or Native American?
Yeah, no, it's absurd.
You know, they can't govern themselves.
It's a ridiculous statement because Bush couldn't govern either, but, you know, there's no way you get those sort of assignments. And, you know, and I resent that just in general about Obama. Now, his leadership problem is, I think, his being wedded to this bipartisanship.
Well, look, I'll take it a step further. His leadership problem stems directly from the University of Chicago.
Well, okay. Yeah, no, I think that he is, I just think maybe he's just a corporatist. I mean, remember what he said about BP? He made the statement saying, well, I just sort of assumed that they knew more about what they were doing than they did. That statement alone, which isn't verbatim, but it's
close enough for government work.
That is like told me so much, and I recoiled. I thought, oh man, we in trouble, big time. You see?
Yeah. I thought they had a handle on the situation. Sure.
That goes back to the Chicago thing you're saying because
Because, well, it's a corporation. They got to be. They wouldn't be rich if they weren't good at it.
Well, exactly. Same thing with him saying Jamie Dimon is a good guy. Da 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 da. And it's because I guess he commands, you know, the largest bank in the world or whatever. So he must be okay. And that kind of talk really bugs me about Obama, because if you compare that to FDR, who was able to turn on a dime on them people when he needed to. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no but you know what? May I submit something for your consideration? This is one of those only Nixon can go to China moments. FDR could do that because he was one of them.
No, but there still was the, you know.
Whereas Barack Obama wants to be one of them.
I guess, but you know, the analysis seems to be escaping. I don't know, or it's just as it is. This is what it is. We're going to have this marriage between government and corporation, and then that's just it. And we got to fend for ourselves.
Right, and government's going to come walking out in the yard every now and then, saying that it walked into a door or fell down the stairs.
Well, no, but I just think that it's more disturbing. I mean, every day it just seems to be more and more disturbing. Like just the headline a few minutes ago, Goldman Sachs settled for $550 million on their connection with the subprime fraud. Are you effing kidding me? That is nothing, Bob. A half a billion?
To them? No, that's chump change.
Right. So I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, what? And their stocks soared after that decision. So, you know, we're in deep trouble here.
Well, did you run off and read the latest Joe Bagent essay?
I haven't had a chance, but I got to check it out. I usually try to catch up with him.
Yeah, that's 30 minutes you owe yourself.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he's saying very much similar things. You know, he's talking about, you know, turning out the lights when the last one leaves the room.
Well, and it's just sort of, you know, I don't know. I'm not into the total calamity thing, because I think that, yeah, whatever, but there's a whole bunch of zillions of people who are going to suffer so badly behind that exercise, and I'm just sort of not feeling that. But I don't know if this man is going to get reelected.
And does that give you the trots, the thought, because whether it's Jeb Bush, and look, I mean, let's get square. Jeb Bush is the best of that lot.
Well, there's also the, don't forget the Petraeus factor. That's like my favorite.
Yeah.
Although.
Yeah, that's going to be electing General Ripper president.
No, I've come down a bit on that one because I unfortunately stumbled upon some emails that he accidentally sent out. Wow. He's real special. These emails were like about how he's going to recover his faith within the Israeli lobby community. Because, you know, when he testified.
Yeah,
that Israel's problems is causing harm to our troops.
Yeah, he's got some real bowing and scraping to do.
Well, he's been doing that, courtesy of Max Boot, who is this sniveling neocon who went to Berkeley. He's horrifying. Anyway, so
Jesus, that sounds, Max Boot sounds like some sort of computer generated nerd.
It's horrible, but he sent these emails, and the one email that he sent to Max Boot was like, he said, "Oh, well, do you think it'll be good if I let it out that I entertained, is it Wiesel? One of the,
Elie Wiesel?
Yeah, him and his wife at my quarters. Will that help?" And then Max Boot said, "Well, no, that's not a problem because you haven't been identified as anti-Semitic yet." And he sent a thing back.
Yet.
Roger that with a smiley face.
You know, I'm almost equally disturbed by the fact that we've got a general of the armies who uses smiley faces in his email.
No, this is what I'm talking about. That's where I'm stuck. I'm like, what the F? So we're just in a lot of smoke and mirrors here. I think that the shit is bad because.
But again, what you're describing, Sandra, I think is another in, you know, tune in next week for more weasel politics in America. What you're describing is a situation where, once again, the Democrats find themselves praying for good outcomes in elections because we're the lesser of two evils. Because we're not as batshit crazy as the other guy.
Oh, and I mean, no, but just, you know, the it's just, it seems like just a crisis. I don't know. I really don't know what's going on. I think that things are incredibly bad, and, you know, the economy seems to be, like, stalled. Have you noticed?
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
And have they passed the unemployment yet?
No, no, but we got the financial reform, and that's what really matters.
Right, and I'm sure stocks will soar tomorrow. I mean, it is such an upside-down world, I guess, you know, as my little niece would say.
You know, you know what? You just reminded me of something when you said stocks will soar. Do you remember that high flight thing they used to play back in the day when TV turned off at midnight? You know, and it had the jet fighter the guy said, "Oh, I have danced on laughter's silvered wings." Yeah, welcome to Wall Street. Reached out my hand and touched the face of God. That's what that's the market response to the kind of tepid legislation that we get out of we get out of the Congress, frankly.
Well, no, but it's incredible because let me get this straight. Am I supposed to believe now that the oil leak has stopped?
It's over. It's done. We can quit. Yeah, we can stop talking about that now.
I mean,
yeah, and you know what did it, Sandra? You know what did it? I'll tell you what made BP get serious. You know, black dude in Washington talking about him and talking about boots on neck and shit like that, that didn't matter. Jimmy Buffett went to Gulf Shores and sang "It's All BP's Fault" as part of Margaritaville, and then BP knew that it was in the deep stuff.
No, because, you know, I'm thinking, you know, because I'll be honest with you, I've hidden out for the last few days or so. I just can't cope. But
can't blame you.
I'm like, oh, wait, it's cat? And I'm thinking, wow. Oh, and before I forget it, quick shout out to Brian. I heard his ass on Mike Malloy.
Oh, cool.
I thought that was quite funny. He was talking pretty slow. It was it was good. Anyway,
bless his heart. I don't know what it is about this program that gets Brian going, but you know it's cool because it happens. I was gonna go somewhere just a minute ago just for the sake of going there. All of this that we're dealing with in terms of, you know, the stock market, the welded, and I asked early in the program, I asked Susan, if this well disaster really is capped, does Barack Obama get any credit? Is he still oppressing BP, or did maybe any of this have to do with the success? Granted, it's success that was in April to May, May to June, June to July. Yeah, 3 months. But does he get any credit, or was his response too slow?
Understand how all of a sudden it's capped, though. But anyway, I
know it's kind of Capricorn One, isn't it? They shot it in one of those NASA tanks with the clear blue water. No, don't think that didn't occur to me.
No, it's just all of it. It's just everything is just so weird, and you know, my confidence in what's going on has been completely shaken. So I'm not trusting my usual sources anymore.
Right.
I think I'm like, you know, I'm not going to fall into the New World Order crowd, but goddamn.
You know you mean you're not going to leave the show to go listen to Alex Jones now?
Oh, no. That's a weird thing, too, because, you know, it's too big on the man behind the curtain hell for me. I'm just like, oh, God.
It's too big on the buy this book for me.
And some gold.
You know, if you're selling a book about angels or New World Orders or orgies in the Bohemian Grove, you're not on the straight.
Or frozen food packs that last for 30 years.
Buy it now.
Well, no, anyway.
But, you know, I was inspired, Sandra, because I saw that, who was it? Well, one of my favorite senators, Ben Cardin from Maryland, had personally delivered chili pod seed stock to the frozen seed bank in Norway, and I'm not making fun of it. I'm glad, you know, I'm glad that future generations after the apocalypse are going to at least be able to season their food.
No, is that eugenicist Microsoft guy? What's his name?
No, Ben Cardin is a senator from Maryland.
No, but the seed thing, didn't Bill Gates put that together?
No, I think the government of Norway did.
Oh, right.
You know, my fear, though, based on what Scott in Sweden and Michael in Norway have told me, is that I'm terrified that half of that cave is taken up in lutefisk and the surströmming, that rotten-ass fish that you can only open up in a desert when the wind's blowing.
Oh, no. Well, listen, I guess, you know, I should let you go. But it's just, I mean, there's so much to cover, and I must go real trivial. Did you get away from the decision?
What?
The LeBron decision?
Oh, no. Because one of our lecturers was a fan.
Oh, and
he kind of went over and looked at his cell phone every time it dinged.
No, that was just over the top and bizarro world. And, you know, it just went off the deep end with that owner losing it.
Bad.
That was bad. I'm like, dude, I guess you don't want no basketball players at all. Shut the hell up.
Yeah, because you're going to whoever leaves, you're trashing.
No, but the thing is, it's just, you know, it was over the top, but these people seem to forget that it's called free agency. You earn it. I don't have no love lost for LeBron, but isn't that how it works? He paid his dues.
And then you go to the highest bidder.
And he can go wherever the hell he wants, right? Isn't that how it works?
Right. I mean, is there anything out there to suggest that Cleveland offered the same money Miami did?
Well, and not only that, but I mean, when you're picked, you don't have no choice. You go to whatever team drafts you, right?
Right. It wasn't. I mean, I guess there was some fooling around and carrying on that took him to Cleveland, since he was native son and all of that stuff.
Right.
But no, I mean, he could have just as easily started his career at Sacramento,
yeah,
or the Clippers.
Yeah, so anyway, but the whole, I mean, I just was sort of like, but it was kind of funny that I'm like, dude, you going to spend an hour throwing Cleveland under the bus? They lost their collective minds. They was burning shit. It was crazy.
Yeah, and Paul the Oracular Octopus went 8-0 predicting soccer matches. I don't know if you saw that, but an octopus somewhere at an aquarium in Germany.
Oh, is that what that was about? I didn't understand. What,
yeah, they would drop two soccer balls with mussels attached to them, you know, the shellfish.
And he picked Spain?
And he picked Spain.
Shut up.
And he picked, he didn't hesitate to pick against the Germans. But what I loved out of that story, Sandra, was that bookies were calling the aquarium trying to buy him.
Oh, Jesus. You know what?
Work, you little cephalopod bastard, or no more muscles.
That's funny, but I had to laugh. Germany got dismissed. I'm like, oops. You know? That was a crazy tournament, you know?
Well, I did. I watched the final between Spain and the Netherlands, and I sent a note to David in Tennessee. I said, hey, wow, I went to a mugging and a soccer match broke out. That, you know, anybody who thinks that ain't a contact sport, you didn't watch that World Cup final.
That first half was strong. It was really quite scary, the sort of physicality for all that. I was sort of amazed. And I was amazed that Argentina got dispatched like they did. I'm like, ooh, yikes.
You know, there's a lot of people going home to a lot of unhappy fellow countrymen.
Well, I know, but see, the thing about South America is in Colombia, where they be blowing people away.
Yeah, yeah. The drug lord had the goalie blown away.
Right.
And Diego Maradona is such an utter and complete ass that, you know, nothing could have happened as much as, you know, never mind, it's unfair to the rest of the squad, but nothing could have happened to the team that he was coaching that he wouldn't have earned. Because, you know, he had a soccer rap sheet of priors as long as your arm.
Shut up. Well, I mean, you know, I suppose it's good for Spain, considering their situation, so I suppose they needed a bit of a pickup.
Well, yeah, they did, and neither team had ever captured the cup before, so we had a new winner, and that was nice. And now we get to start, you know, figuring out, because you know that Barack is on the trail to get the World Cup in 2018.
For the U.S.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Right, right. Where is it going to be next time, though?
Oh, it's in the beating heart of soccer. It's in Brazil.
Brazil, that's right. Brazil,
they'll probably build a new stadium by razing down the cardboard villages of a few million poor people.
Well, this is the thing about 2012 that I was sort of, when I heard that they got the Olympics, I was like, that's the first thing I thought of, because they're going to have to move a whole bunch of poor people.
But the other side of that coin, Sandra, is the fact that Brazil is, everybody talks about India, everybody talks about China, and this is a little hello from the global south that, that Brazil and the countries like Brazil are going to have some say-so in all of this, too. You know, those guys are going to, they're going to be, like, fully sustainable in what, 10 more years, 15 more years?
Well, that's because they got rid of that neoliberal shit.
Right, and then they're gonna be not only free of the white man, but they're gonna be free of the Middle Eastern man too.
Well, yeah, no. The sort of energy policies, yeah. I mean, listen, I don't even know what kind of country, just my little nieces are gonna be living in just 20 years up the road here.
I am not at all comfortable, because I've got, I've been talking about promoting Horn Intern Junior Grade Ferg up to Horn Intern Ferg, and maybe after Netroots Nation promoting up all the way up to Horn Apprentice.
Mm-hmm.
But the world he's in, he sat there watching and listening to all of this deep discussion of America's foundings, and then to turn around, look where it is, and wonder where it's going. I'm sorry, as a father, and you as an auntie, there's something wrong with you if you're not worrying about that world.
Well, yeah, and to be honest, I'll be honest with you, it's really because these little people are in my life that I actually, give a F. Trust me, I've been places, I could easily be somewhere else, not very nice. But since I have these youngins in my life, I'm concerned. I can't be just a selfish C that I used to be or can be again, if you know what I'm saying.
I do. Sandra, have a wonderful evening.
Yeah, you too.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye now. The Sage of Sacramento, that is Sandra, and let's see if we can get one more call in. Hey, welcome to the program.
And this is her underling in Sacramento, Marty. Hi.
Hey, Marty, what, Minion? Are you? Have you promoted yourself to Minion?
Oh, follower, whatever, take your choice.
Acolyte?
In other words, I haven't tried to go home yet because I can't get home and listen to any part of the last hour. So it's like, and there's nobody here, so calling from work. I was going to say, you were talking about how much LeBron James might have gotten from Cleveland. He'd have gotten $30 million this day, $30 million more because of the salary cap thing in basketball. But it was like, I just found it interesting. It's like ESPN gave him
an hour
to do that. And funny thing, I wouldn't have watched it except I was driving home at the time, and I was listening to Sports Talk Radio, and they're playing the thing. I'm going,
yeah, they're simulcasting.
Well, they played part of it. They didn't play the whole thing.
I haven't seen anything this silly since Who Wants to Marry a Millionaire.
Exactly. Thank you very much. I keep thinking this is what our bread and circus society has come down to. It's like we're one basketball player deciding where he's going to play.
Right. The news, so-called news, more like television Rwanda, Fox. They cut away from Democrats asking questions of Elena Kagan, but meanwhile LeBron gets an hour on ESPN.
And
it's not even an hour he had to pay for.
And I keep forgetting. Wasn't Fox talking about Lindsay Lohan in those places?
Yeah, I don't think there's been an hour of TV ratings as high as LeBron since the premiere of Roots.
probably not. It was funny. You guys were talking about the World Cup as well. By the way, she was mentioning 2012 in Rio. No, 2012 is in London.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And 2016 is in Rio. Which I keep thinking, maybe that's why Rio got it, because they will already have had the World Cup and a lot of infrastructure. They'll be able to apply a lot of their...
Yeah, and Barack's trying to get the World Cup for 18.
And apparently that representative, which hasn't been chosen yet, but apparently one of them my father tells me is possibly Houston. Are you going to want to... I want to meet the person who wants to play in Houston, Texas.
In high summer.
In high summer, in stadiums without domes on them. It's like...
Yeah, which would then necessitate, yeah, with the dome, it would necessitate playing on, you know, stuff horses can't eat. You know, I could
no,
see.
No, they've got that thing the Astros play in, and Reliant Stadium. Those things, those things open.
That's true. But still, and you know, how poison is the Gulf Coast going to be in 2018, especially since we can't seem, Marty, to get these idiots to stop drilling until they've figured out how to solve their problems that happen while they're drilling.
I don't know. Will any of us be alive in 2000? I keep thinking.
You know, it all happens on Christmas Eve 2012. So what the hell are we worrying about?
I thought it was the 21st. I thought it was a few days before that. But
if it's not over by Christmas, well, I'm counting on Christmas Eve because that way I don't have to buy Christmas presents that year.
Okay, I can go along with that. And I don't have to worry about traveling. I keep thinking, well, let's see. Personally, I think it's going to be the biggest non-event since Y2K, but who am I?
Yeah, don't forget Comet Kahutek in the grand pantheon of big flops. But yeah.
Well, Y2K was more recent. I remember my sister going over and talking about all this, and I'm a computer resource specialist.
My computer's gonna eat me on January the 1st, 2000.
It's all gonna fail. I'm certain this was the precursor to the reaction of 9/11 when the Homeland Security, the alert levels, the color alert levels, and the things were near red, and there was the guy in New Jersey who duct taped and plasticed over his house.
Oh.
And I remember thinking, so that was an outgrowth of this, which stems from Kahutek, which, you know, love him afterwards, which goes back to, which has to go back to Orson Welles and that radio play of War of the
Worlds. And you know, it culturally, Marty, it goes back to human nature, because there's something inside human beings, I think from time immemorial, that makes us recognize in our own individual mortality. We've got this mass death fantasy that, well, you know, I'm going to die someday, but so are we all at the same time. And in a way, it's kind of weird, because I think there's some sort of cultural comfort in it.
But it also showed that using this electronic media, you could generate one hell of a mass panic. I mean,
and sell a bunch of freeze-dried roast beef.
They were selling freeze-dried roast beef when Orson Welles was doing that. No, sorry. But you understand what I'm saying is, I mean, that mass extinction thing is like, okay, if we're all around, say, Mount St. Helens, and Mount St. Helens happens to go up, or better yet, the supervolcano under Yellowstone happens to go off full bore, it's like, okay, now, you know, now we're talking something. That's something real we're reacting to. We're reacting to a bloody theory or a radio play. Or the fact that the Aztec Mayans might probably just run out of stone when they ended the calendar.
Oh, I saw that editorial cartoon too. Hey, Marty, I got to roll because we are short of time, but at least you get to go home now.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
All right. Marty, take care.
Talk to you later. Right.
Bye now. And that's Marty, who gets the last word. It is 3.5 minutes past the hour. That means it's time for me to knock off and quit, so we can all go listen to Malloy. Thanks for joining in. It's been a lot of fun this evening, and I'll be back here tomorrow night, and then Monday night, and then it gets weird. Another reminder: it has been mighty dry here at the Horn, and contributions would fall gratefully upon parched earth if you have the wherewithal to do so. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen: our chief engineer, John Fox in Australia, also our webmaster, our web designer, made a lot of the. He made access to the Ustream the videos available on the Horn homepage. Many thanks, as ever, go out to John. Also to our IT professional, Peter Godbold, and to Ben Birch, the hardest working man in liberal talk, no kidding, since 2002. There'd be no liberal talk on the Internet without Ben Birch. I am absolutely convinced. WhiteRoseSociety.org. He's had some tech problems, but he says they'll be solved in short order. For those of you waiting for the podcast, it'll be up as soon as I can send the audio file to him. So I will do that as soon as the show is over. Thanks to our chat room moderator, Lottie, to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, to our blogger, Texas Betsy. I got a story from her that I guess we'll save for Friday on the front porch. It's really appropriate to that because it's a laugher. It is a scream. Thanks to my head writer, David in Tennessee. Our op-ed columnist at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is Reverbo. And our Southeast correspondent and my colleague at the soon-to-be Netroots Nation is Matt Osborne of Osborne, Inc., OSBORNEINK.com. Do you follow Matt on Twitter? If not, you should. Are you friends on Facebook? If not, you should. Thanks also go out to one of the partial sponsors of Netroots Nation and an ongoing long-time sponsor of this program and this network, and that is Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net and coalriverwind.org. They are, in fact, the hardest-working, bravest people I know. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.